listening to Fakeologist Audio Chat. To connect to our always-on and always-streaming audio chat, go to audiochat.fakeologist.com. This is a new and exciting way to communicate with fellow fakeologists around the globe. Each day we compress and post the day's audio into a file that can be big or small. Discover new voices and ideas that talk about media fakery like you never did before. To listen to the live stream, go to s3.fakeologist.com. Now, on with the audio chat.
I think everybody is present and correct there, John. So we probably need a little bit of an introduction. It's the 29th of the 11th, 2017. It's 21:37 British Standard Time, Greenwich Mean Time. We're in the Fakeologist live stream on Discord. We've got John Adams, announcers out today, Mahatma Colt, Mism, Not So Freemason, and Typo Error. And we're discussing jazz. John's got a bit of a geekathon coming on. So we thought we'd bring him in here, at least that way, gives us a chance to refer back to it in audio to see how geeky he actually gets. So I think, take it away, John.
Moment.
Well, I had brought up this article that I found in The Guardian where they list a bunch of jazz musicians that were Freemasons. It sounds like John's away from the mic or something right now. So
you know what? I was actually talking and I didn't know my mic was off.
Oh, there we go. Here he is.
That's funny. But yeah, go ahead with the article. We'll start off with the article.
Yeah, so they list Nat King Cole, Sun Ra, Count Basie, Dizzy Gillespie, W.C. Handy, Lionel Hampton, Al Robeson, as well as Glenn Miller, Paul Whiteman, George Gershwin, Irving Berlin, all Freemasons.
Okay, that's an interesting list there. So we got George Gershwin, W.C. Handy, what'd you say, Irving Berlin. Those guys kind
of Sun Ra.
Sun Ra is a little later, but those guys kind of predate jazz. It's kind of a time period where jazz and pop music are pretty much the same thing, especially George Gershwin. Cole Porter is another one. Cole Porter was actually a member of Skrull and Key at Yale, if I remember correctly. So you had these guys. These guys were songwriters.
Well, it's Skull and Key as tied in with the opium trade as Skull and Bones would be, because isn't that a pretty good vehicle they used for opiates? Well,
yeah, that's an interesting point. Skrull and Key is where the artists come out of. It's the art fraternity.
Mm-hmm.
So you have Skull and Bones is kind of the right hand path, and Skrull and Key is more of the limp-wristed left hand path. And Cole Porter was gay, so just to give you an indication there. So you had these songwriters, and these guys were writing things. I'm picking on Cole Porter in particular. I like a lot of Cole Porter songs, but Cole Porter wrote a song called Anything Goes. And he wrote this song at a particular time during the jazz age where it's, and if anybody wants to pull up the lyrics to Anything Goes, in a certain context, those lyrics could fit quite well in today's world. It's just basically talking about all of the decadence and debauchery that was going on during the jazz age of the 1920s. And Freemasonry and jazz are pretty... You know, there's a lot of stuff that kind of interlocks with that. As far as the ideas, there's a lot of freedom. A lot of jazz songs have the word freedom in it. There's an even much later in the 1960s, you have a style of jazz called free jazz, which is basically just people making noise. So there's always been that kind of idea of freedom attached to it, and it's because jazz is spontaneous, it's improvisational. And so it's a directed thing from the top down. Now, does that necessarily mean that every single artist was in on something or anything like that? No, of course not. but you were given the template, you were kind of given the vehicle as to how that was going to play itself out in culture. And so, like you're saying, so like I was saying, those guys you mentioned, those guys were songwriters. They provided, you know, for how many years would that have been? George Gershwin, Cole Porter, W.C. Handy, Irving Berlin. Those guys' music, still to this very day, are all, first of all, they weren't really, it wasn't really jazz, like I was saying at the time, but it became adopted by jazz, and it was kind of like the equivalent of, like, Bob Dylan to the rock world, where everybody covers a Bob Dylan song at some point. And those guys that you mentioned, who are these Freemasons or fraternal order members, still to this day, people play George Gershwin, Cole Porter, Irving Berlin songs. And it's over 100 years later. And it could be because they are very well-crafted songs, but you also have to take into account that there's another reason that anybody heard them in the first place, and then also how they became kind of the icons of the era, the kind of go-to. That's another thing, and like I said, we're not guilty of this. This is kind of just how we're all kind of constructed, but if you just notice in the music video chat room on Discord, where we all participate, we're, you know, we're having a laugh, we're having some fun, we're sending each other, you know, videos and songs, and, hey, check this out, look at how talented this person is, hey, look at how lame this video is, or whatever it is. But music, ever since way before we were born, became a vehicle for communication. So it's a way to communicate with each other, it's a way to identify a certain feelings or things, and you feel that maybe somebody has, you know, some songwriter has kind of captured the idea that you want to convey to somebody else. So you play a song for your loved one and say, you know, this totally encapsulates how I feel about something. All down through, and how this relates to fakery is, once again, you have a, for a very long time, from, like I said, the turn of the century until about the 1960s, until about the mid-60s, jazz is pretty much dominates music to a, you know, lesser or more extent. And when rock and roll comes in, rock and roll at first kind of, it still had one foot in the jazz, it still had one foot in jazz, because rock and roll is kind of a derivative it's a derivative of a derivative of jazz, which was called jump blues. And jump blues was artists like Louis Jordan or Wynonie Harris. They're kind of rock and roll before rock and roll. And then another Freemason who came along and was promoted by the record industry was Bill Haley, with Bill Haley and his Comets. And Bill Haley, I think I've talked about this before on other calls, but Bill Haley was just a country singer who didn't make it as a country singer. I actually got some of the recordings of Bill Haley's band before they were Bill Haley and the Comets, and it's just kind of run-of-the-mill kind of country stuff for the time. And then,
just got to jump in there, John, because that's another one of them bands where the name of the singer makes sense with the band name.
It's appropriate, right?
Very appropriate, and they just didn't want to let that slip.
No, that's a good point, because actually their biggest hit, the one that kicked it off for everybody, is Rock Around the Clock. Rock Around the Clock. Rock Around the Clock was not written by Bill Haley. It was actually a product of Decca Records. And Decca Records used a Knights of Pythias, I think that's how you say it, Pythias, Knights of Pythias Lodge to record as a record studio in New York City. So it is a Freemasonic fraternal offshoot lodge where they are recording the first rock and roll record. And there was a demo made for it before.
Start as you mean to go on.
Yeah, there was a demo made for it. It was called Rock Around the Clock, but it was done by a band called Sunny Day and the Knights.
Oh, I've heard it. It's better. It's actually better.
Sunny Day and the Night.
Mm.
And Knights is spelled K-N-I-G-H-T-S, as in the Knights of Pythias. Okay, so right. It was a house band. There was a house band at Decca Records, and it was just the musicians there, and they just called themselves Sunny Day and the Knights for that record. And then Bill Haley cut that record and became rock and roll was kicked off. The particular bands piano players, some form of jazz-oriented stuff. And it kind of, jazz did kind of pave the way for rock and roll. Like you said, Dizzy Gillespie was a Freemason. I'm pretty sure Miles Davis was a Freemason. Of course, Dizzy Gillespie and Miles Davis were in the Charlie Parker sextet at one time. And those guys are considered pretty much the guys who broke away from traditional jazz altogether and created what was called bebop, which kind of led to beatniks and beat poetry, and that turns into the hippie movement and that type of stuff. I'm not saying those guys are directly responsible for that. They were just kind of these rock stars of this particular style of music that took off.
Really turned into the Situationist International, didn't it?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the beat poetry and that type of stuff, extended out into Southern California, San Francisco, Northern California and San Francisco. That's where you get Jack Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg. Allen Ginsberg was back and forth between New York City and there. All those guys were, and they all very shady backgrounds. There's plenty of stuff out there on a lot of these guys.
Ginsberg was a nonce, wasn't he?
What's that?
Ginsberg was a nonce. He was a member of the Nonsense Association in America.
Yeah. And he's also a member of NAMBLA.
What was the name? Member of...
That's the North American Marlon Brando Lookalike Association.
The narrative goes that he was a MK Ultra experiment guinea pig as well at Stanford University, but that's also where his archives are. They paid him like a couple million dollars to have his archives, and he sold them to the very university that experimented on him against his knowledge.
Yeah.
All right.
That makes sense to me. But he's also like against the government. He's a revolutionary type. His character, his lifetime acting character is. But then why would you, do that? Sell your archive to that place?
Mm-hmm. That type of stuff. You got to wonder with these guys if they're just lifetime actors. They're playing the role, the cultural role that it called for in that particular time period. Interestingly enough, is a lot of this, it's kind of a lot of this type of stuff is used as a vehicle, especially in black culture at that time period, is kind of a move towards ending segregation runs through jazz music. This is not to debate segregation or any of that type of stuff.
It's a precursor for the civil rights movement type of thing.
Yes, it is a vehicle for delivering messages towards ending segregation. My position on this particular subject is that even though I enjoy the company of friends who are black or, work with black people and that type of stuff, it's has nothing to do with that, has nothing to do with that whatsoever. They wanted, just like with women in an earlier time period, was to get women in the workplace to create a new tax bracket, to create a new cog in the wheel that was going to be part of the workforce. And so black communities weren't integrated into the white man slave world yet. they still had their own businesses, they still had their own communities, their own thing, and they stayed within their own groups and didn't really go outside. Well, when you bring in the idea of segregation and better jobs, oh, you know, let's tear down, you know, old Joe's barber shop and build a, you know, Montgomery Ward there instead, that type of stuff. And that did happen. That happened with, especially after that. And then, of course, you see the decline, you see the kind of cultural warfare that kind of went along with that, because a lot of decadence and kind of free, open lifestyle was promoted with that breakdown of that culture as it got integrated. And there's books even written on, there's even mainstream books written about that, seeing how integrating two cultures into each other was going to be chaotic. There's going to be a hard time for people to assimilate, and it would take generations to assimilate. And that was correct. It was most likely a order out of chaos type scenario. And like I was saying, jazz music played a part as being a vehicle within that. And there's other little things, like little Masonic things I've pointed out before, is Miles Davis has an album. One of his more famous songs is a song called Seven Steps to Heaven. And if you're a Mason, you know what the seven steps to heaven are. That's the first 7 degrees of Freemasonry.
So it's Roy Lodge.
What's that?
Roy Lodge Freemasonry.
Yeah. Yeah, and the seven steps to heaven are referred to as Jacob's Ladder. Of course, Cedar Walton, another jazz pianist, has an album called Jacob's Ladder. So this kind of stuff runs throughout Freemasonry. I mean, it runs throughout classical music as well. Obviously, there's mainstream books you get that you can get when you go to school on Mozart being a Freemason. Like there's a book called Mozart and Freemasonry, and it goes through how he would actually write his songs in a Masonic fashion. So Magic Flute is a Masonic opera, but not only just Magic Flute. So like if you took dun 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 dun. So there's this, like I was saying, there's this book, Mozart and Freemasonry. I was reading it.
Is that Ode to Spring?
I believe so, yeah.
I don't know. It's in a film, isn't it? And I've read it. I mean, it's in trading places.
The configuration of the notes, it's what, 7 and 3?
Is this what brings us into the quadrivium, musical place in time? Is that the art that is falling down to? Because it does seem like when Mahatma there mentioned there the Royal Arch of Enoch, I mean, that incorporates a lot of mathematics that is relevant if you've got the mind to understand it, and it's the same with this musical place in time, as is the astronomy part of the quadrivium. Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
Like the placing of the notes?
Yeah, I'm not a total expert in that. If you go back to listen to the first call we did with Hans Utter,
he's very technical, love, and he says it so it's almost romantic as he's saying it. It's like poetry coming off his tongue, and it makes sense, but unless he's there walking you through it, it's hard to understand.
Basically, it's number in time, basically.
So it's musical place in time.
Mozart believed he believed in Freemasonry as a power. So he believed if he placed notes in a certain configuration in 3-6, 3-6, 7-7-7, he would, that has a power over the listener. And because he believed in the occult power of numbers, he believed in 3s, 6s, and 7s and the occult, the particular meanings that they have, he came up with songs. And like I said, I'm just giving the one example, but there's multiple ones of his songs where the notes are compiled and configured in groups of numbers for the purpose of occult magic. So
yeah, that makes perfect sense. I understand. It's almost like once these gentlemen had discovered that, it was so it was so compelling. And I don't mean these gentlemen in particular, talking about the people that taught it. Once they discovered the relevancy of these certain individual numbers within music, it didn't seem coincidence, so they put it on a pedestal. Is that what you're thinking? That's the way the Masons pushed this, because it was new, so to speak.
Yeah, I think...
Just like if someone was pushing anti-gravitic technology today or hydro power today because, you know, they had some... It gave them some sort of inspiration. Do you think this is the same sort of inspiration coming from these people?
Well, it's either one of two things, and I'll say I don't know which one it is. It's either a person making something and believing that it has power over people, and thus just by them believing it and having self-confidence, they're able to persuade people, or there is some sort of scientific mechanism that I'm totally unaware of.
I don't think you can disassociate the two. I'll be honest with you there. Yep. They're probably the same thing, John.
Yeah, I wouldn't doubt it. But I don't know. It's like, I mean, I've written many songs in my life, but I never, ever considered writing it in a fashion to where it was configured for some sort of numerical makeup or whatever. You know, it was just kind of...
Well, I've heard flashbacks of bands that have gone all eccentric, and the stuff that they produce when they've gone all eccentric has never amounted to anything that they produced, which was ad hoc, so to speak. So, musical placings, I'm sure it works for a lot of classical music, because I love classical music. I really do. I love it. Mm-hmm. And I love it that much that I've never bought any. I can just put classic FM on all day. So, yeah, that makes sense. But obviously, if you're just doing everything robotically and numerically, we've seen how stuff turns out. So, yeah, there must be an art to it, a fine art to it.
Well, there's definitely something to it at some point. So the point I was getting at by bringing up Mozart, and then if you went into Miles Davis' song, Seven Steps to Heaven, it's dun, 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 dun. So that is seven notes. And that's the melody of the tune is based off of seven notes. So they incorporate this idea into the song and then give the song a Masonic title as well, right? The idea of rocking and rolling is an interesting one, because rocking and rolling in original pre-rock and roll slang has to do with sex. So that was a slang term for amongst, you know, black musicians for sex. If you were rocking and rolling all night long, that's what it's talking about. So I think one of the examples we brought up on past calls is that song. You know, everybody might be familiar with it. I think it's in the movie Stand By Me, but it's by Shirley and Lee, and it's called Come On Baby, Let the Good Times Roll. And in that song, you're thinking about, well, oh, yeah, they're talking about going out and dancing. But she says to him in the song, she says, "Feels so good when you're home. Come on, baby, rock me all night long." Like, I thought you guys were going out dancing. You see, and this is a song from the 1950s. So it's still used within that particular, vernacular, I guess. It's rock and roll and meant sex.
And the Animals did a wonderful version of that, by the way.
Oh, yeah, yeah. They did a lot of good covers.
It says here on Wiktionary it's been used from at least 1914 by Trixie Smith in the song My Man Rocks Me with Only One Steady Roll. That was the original usage. But, yeah, they attribute it to African Americans, mm-hmm. meaning to have sexual intercourse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. But that's an interesting thing in and of itself, because rock has a connotation to a penis. I'll just be blunt. You know, a rock isn't, you know, an obelisk. Rock, if you say, you know, somebody, I don't want to get I don't want to get vulgar on the audio chat here, but I'm just saying it's like using it for the example that people use it is like I'm hard as a rock. I'm rock hard.
Well, get your rocks off.
Get your rocks off.
Get exactly. your rocks off, honey.
Oh, so, hold on.
You're listening to another hour of Fakeologist Audio Chat on Fakeologist.com.
That was some rock hard beats there.
I've been air raped.
Yes, I believe.
Cheers up.
Rocks, yeah, get your rocks off. So in Napoleon there was singing the, was that Primal Scream?
Yes, Primal Scream. Yeah, dealers keep a dealing, thieves keep a thieving, hoes keep hoeing, junkers keep scoring.
Yeah, and then Def Leppard had a song called Rocks Off. So yeah, in slang and in all that type of stuff, rock has to do with sex, but also has to do with, you know, that. But well, Masons talk about rocks. Right, you know, there's the ashlar stone turning, you know,
round the block, like you said.
Yeah, around the block, all, you know, new kids on the block, right?
Hanging tough. We're rough
on the block.
There's no thing.
It's hip to be square. Yes, Mason, go ahead.
I think Freemason wanted to say something first.
Well, I was just throwing a chip off the old block, if no one said that one already.
Oh, yeah, chip off the old block, yes.
I was thinking because that was a big cycle that we made now from the 20s to the 60s. And I have the impression that before the 50s, it was not so strongly consumerized and sexualized as after the 50s. So I would say,
correct.
Do you see that like that? Okay. I was just thinking, you know, my problem would be to understand if there was a genuine aspect of the creation of jazz, because after the 50s we see clearly that all cultural elements are from the beginning or even before, and you further in time the more it's clearly conceptual made, like for example techno in the 90s first comes the Yeah, something like that. But in the beginning of the 20th century, there are elements which I was just asking that if there is, can we say for sure that the beginnings of jazz in even 1910, that was also conceptualized, or was it a genuine movement like that?
Movement. I think one thing is we'll always need talent. It always has to have talent but it's the way that it's used. So from the beginning, jazz was commercialized. The term Tin Pan Alley, I don't know if anybody's familiar with this term, but the Tin Pan Alley in New York City was where songwriters used to go to sell their songs to become sheet music so that it could be sold. And so Tin Pan Alley is all, you know, associated with Irving Berlin or later on, you know, trying to think of some names. But, you know, it becomes associated with playwrights, you know, people using their music in plays, Jerome Kern, can't think of all those names off the top of my head. It doesn't matter though. It had become commercialized at that point. It doesn't take away from the talent of the individuals, but the talent has the right connections. You know, I think a lot of times because just in the times that we've all been alive, we've seen that there's more emphasis on commercialization than there is on talent. So you might think to yourself, oh, well, you know, someone who's a terrible pop artist, like, you know, Katy Perry or Justin Bieber or whoever, or, you know, even people from past decades, you're thinking, my God, this is terrible.
Fuck music. Katy Perry.
To quote Rochella, yes.
Harry Tourette's of Rochella.
So you tend to kind of think like, oh well, it's all kind of based around these talentless individuals, like the commercial aspect and all that. It wasn't really like that in previous time periods, because there was it was a burgeoning business, and people still required people to be talented in order to buy stuff. So, you know, it still required an amount of talent at that time period. We've gotten to a point where it's such a refined business and a refined art of manipulation that you can just manipulate people into like crap. So, and that's been that way for quite a while. But, you know, even, oh, another one I didn't go into was classical music used as a tool of social engineering. So,
I was just about to mention that, because you mentioned Mozart, and there's stories about people going mental over Beethoven and stuff, particularly youngsters. But the other day we were talking about and Stravinsky,
yes,
being like culture creators.
Yeah, that's what I was gonna say. Stravinsky's Rites of Spring is a milestone as far as like a shift, a complete shift in the direction of music. And there's even stories that he was kind of aware, I would say this is probably true, that he was aware of the effect that this music was going to have on the music world as far as kind of sparking an outrage.
It's unquestionable, like with the rhythm, the warlike rhythm, he's going to produce like blood up. You know what I mean?
So, Mahatma's talking about is the first time it was ever performed, a riot broke out because people became angry, not only angry because they were mad at, you know, the nature of the music and being upset that they didn't like it. It was because the music itself, if you go listen to it, it's basically like a heavy metal song played in classical music.
Yeah.
I mean, there's actually bands out there who have made heavy metal versions of it. So it's a pretty heavy song, and it was accompanied by a ballet performance that was very unconventional, and I'd say it's probably like the first postmodern dance piece, even before postmodernism. And so all of these elements combined sparked an outrage, kind of created an air of anger. And, yeah, it was definitely social engineering, no doubt. Of course, Stravinsky went on to be the professor of music at USC much later on. And then across town at UCLA at the same time, the professor of music was Schoenberg. So no matter what school you went to, you got the the dialectic going on there. Is there anything you wanted to
Satie,
add about that?
Satie as well, he was a big theosophist and held like conventions and stuff like that, if I remember right.
He was a Rosicrucian, yeah.
And theosophist, yeah. If you read his scores, he's got different instructions for each bar, different mood, and if you really apply yourself and do it, it does work. It's like scatterbrained from this mood to that mood to that mood to that mood. You know what I mean?
Yes, absolutely. And if you listen to any of
it's a headbender.
It is. If you listen to any of the Gymnopedies, I guess that's I don't know how to say it, but
I know Gymnopedia 1, but I don't know the other two.
Yeah. So
I know Nocian 3, but I don't know the other.
Yeah, so you listen to his body of work, and like you're saying, it's very scatterbrained, and even the ones that are in sequence, like the Gymnopedies, they're very, un- not not only unconventional avant-garde pieces, but their mood, like Mahatma saying, their moods change. So it's kind of a strange thing. Of course, you know, we both like Erik Satie, but he was a house organist for the Rosicrucian Lodge in France, I think, in Montmartre.
Yeah.
And so he was, and some of his pieces, I can't remember what the name of that piece is, but it's actually got Rosicrucian in the title. In any case, so there was social engineering and changing of culture through classical music.
Well, I just found this in the book Classical Music in America, A History of Its Rise and Fall. This piece about Chicago says, Chicago is where social control most credibly applies to institutions of music. The psychology of social crisis and class conflict was more acute than elsewhere. It was in Chicago that Rose Faye Thomas distinguished the highest forms of art and their elite audience from cheap musical entertainments for riffraff and the masses. Chicago was where the Auditorium Theater was built in response to Ferdinand Peck's call for social engineering. A leading historian of Gilded Age Chicago has identified quote-unquote culture, meaning top-down, high culture, as Chicago's answer to social instability. A study of Chicago's Gilded Age cultural institutions states that Anglo-Saxon benefactors attempted, quote, to use art to alter what disturbed them about American life, end quote. And to be sure, the Chicago Orchestra was not the kind of answer articulated at Hull House, where Jane Addams influentially rejected the ideal of philanthropy as a unilateral act of enlightenment, just as she has rejected top-down social reform. Had Charles Norman Fay mainly had social engineering in mind, he would not have made, they're saying it's not all social engineering here, but did any of that, because I don't know much about classical music, let alone Chicago's branch of it, but did any of that ring true with you, John?
It sounds like they're admitting that the promotion of high culture and art was used as a tool of social engineering, which, whichever way you want to slice it, when it comes to social engineering or kind of positivism, like social science, that's where you get this, you start getting these, and Meesom could probably talk a little bit about that better than me, but you start getting into, elite people who believe that what they do is the best thing. So you have a slippery slope and a sticky situation when you start doing that, when you start believing that even if something could be true, let's just say that classical music would be great and wonderful if everybody liked it, and you promote that as a tool of social engineering, one, that's never going to be true. So, you know, there might be somebody out there who likes something. You know, we all break down into, you know, naturally into different individual things. So it's like, well, I'm going to promote high culture and promote classical music, and I'm going to promote Mozart. Well, not everybody's going to like Mozart, and not everybody's going to like Bach, and not everybody's going to like, you know, whatever. So that's the problem when you get into social engineering as kind of a, and it still goes on today.
Like John Loder, he produced all these bands, like he was a member of Crass, and he produced Fugazi and Ministry and bands like that, Babes in Thailand and whatever. He went to a city university in London, and that's an elite one, studying sound and that.
Yeah.
Bloke, he was without a Crass.
Yeah.
His dad was a spy who worked for the World Bank. So, you know, they just, and they sort of began the sort of UK version of Sub Project 58.
Yeah.
You know, MKUltra, the sort of travelling scene, the festival scene. There's a thread running right through it, I agree, yeah.
Well, that's an interesting thing, because even if you have you know, down through history, even if you were to come to the conclusion that classical music would be the best thing to promote and the best thing for everybody to listen to, you don't have the elitists continuing to promote that. You know,
yeah.
I can, like I said, there's at USC right here in Los Angeles, there's the world famous KUSC, which is a classical radio station, and they've been playing classical music for however long. It's still the quote unquote arts are still promoted, but it's a very strange thing because it's obviously not that popular overall. I mean, classical music and jazz music and any of that type of stuff is, you know, ask any jazz musician if they're making a lot of money. Yeah.
I'm sorry. I think there is also one other parameter. If one takes under consideration that to learn, for example, to play violin, it takes you 20 years and you have to invest in that. If we see what is the pattern of our social construction today, it is much cheaper to have a Katy Perry, for example, which doesn't have to sing. She can sing playback, and you have to dress her up
from
the film industry.
Mism, can you hear me?
Yes.
Mahatma Colt was having problems hearing you then. Can you still? Sorry, I'm just interrupting now. Can you? Sorry, he's dropped out. Let's just see if he drops back in.
No, he said he had a refresh.
Ah, right. I wasn't sure. Sometimes Del Qua has the same problem.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Sorry, Miss, I didn't mean to interrupt there, darling. Sorry.
No problem. I understand it.
Keep going with what you're saying about Katy Perry. You could dress her up.
Yes, I was just saying it is not economical. This pattern of the high society of the 19th century it is not applicable to the situation today. You have to have cheaper products, and but there still is classical music is promoted, but it is then very elitistic. It is not popular. And it is too expensive. That's just what I mean. So you have to, for example, the classical orchestra of Bern has to be subventioned from the state. You have to pay it with your tax money so that it can work, because otherwise no one can invest in it. But actually,
Very honest, dead quick. To me, classical music is the equivalent of an exotic animal nowadays. I love classical music, I really do. And where I work with Manchester University, I do see lots of young students with instruments. And it's not the music that basically funds their, you know, their career. They have to be academics and other sorts. So it's almost like the commitment that's needed for these instruments goes hand in hand with academia. Does that make sense?
I cannot answer it generally. Only from my experience in my environment, it does not apply. What I experience here is that it is either or. The academy is a separate way. The people who go into the classical music are supported only in that by their own parents, because they have some they have this environment that they give it to their children somehow like that. It's very special. It's not mass culture.
In my world, classical music is very inexpensive. The place I live in, Geelong, has a very strong training of classical musicians. It has a local orchestra and what they call the Geelong Junior Strings and numerous other things. And they put together quite substantial performances fairly economically. So the idea that it's all very expensive, I think, is part of the mistake that's put to it. And I think part of the reason is so that they can justify building stupid art centres and so on in Melbourne. You know, so you have to have a lot of pomp and circumstance to have. I'm sure every major city has a really, really expensive chamber, a place where a chamber orchestra plays, and there's a lot of brouhaha about it. And everyone wears all the women wear ball gowns, and the men wear duck suits, and there's champagne flutes everywhere. There's a lot of BS, isn't there?
You know, it's true. It exists, but what I wanted to say, maybe I didn't express it well. If you have something that you think as a society that is preferable for your children, for the next generation, you have to support it. And that means today financial support also. But the field of classical music or even jazz music, which counts as classical, I would say, meanwhile, is not supported as an education for all. It is supported only for a few and for a really insider club, something like that.
I agree with, but I don't think it's because of the expense of it. Because I mean, I'm just talking about my own experience with my own children.
Okay.
I mean, quite reasonable musical instruments, violins and so on, were quite modest in price. Certainly no more than than an expensive laptop or anything. So, you know, I don't think it's beyond the reach of many parents to buy their child a half-size violin or anything like that. But I don't think it's the expense so much. It is, I think, a sort of determination to keep classical music with a certain mystique and, you know, so that we can revere.
Ah, you mean that to protect it from mass persuasion so that it stays elitistic, something like that?
That's what I think its purpose is. Its purpose is to differentiate, another divide and conquer strategy.
Yes, yes. I just don't think like that, you know, that there is some subject.
So it is attached to academia.
That decides to promote this and not to promote that. I think it is the automatism of capitalism. If you have 10 Katy Perrys, well, it's automatically like that. Children want to listen to that, or they listen to Shakira when they're 12 or something, even if they play themselves violin.
I do understand what you're saying there. It's going to be a danger. But the auditoriums for universities where they play these type of music, and also where they disseminate lots of like similar to TED Talks, where people go in and, you know, basically pledge to the students that this is what you're learning and this makes sense, it's true. So when a student is learning an instrument, or a student's been learning an instrument for an awful long time, it does go hand in hand with the academia career. And if they are elitist enough, they get to play at all these big, and I mean wonderful auditoriums where they've had millions and millions of pounds spent on them. It's not the same as a band picking up instruments and playing them. So there is a level of academia attached to playing being a classical instrument player, should I say. Does that make sense? It is revered and it is protected, like Frank's saying. It's very protected. It will never die out.
There is another aspect to classical music for the particular time period that it was a popular music. Classical music used to be tied at the hip to nationalism.
Yes.
For the particular regions that the artists came from.
Yes, that's very important, because it is really bound also with German idealism.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And French idealism and nationalism that goes hand in hand, and if we see, for example, the Imperium did not produce its own classical idealistic school of thought, let's say. It was always a little more into the pragmatic reality, economy, etc. Military, of course. Maybe it is also a reason for this big change between 19 and 1920.
Oh, well, I was going to say is that classical music was what it succeeded in doing two things. And there's two schools that run through kind of every region. Is you have kind of ultra-nationalistic music, but then you have the rebels that were kind of the voice of the people. So if you were living in Bohemia and you were under Austrian rule, there was music for your region that was kind of anti-Austro-Hungarian Empire. The music itself was a collective expression of the people of that country. And if you were ultra-nationalistic or you had a people who were rebellious to whatever leadership they were under, this actually created the atmosphere for World War One. And I think classical music, just like music today or in the 1960s, it helped to foment those ideas that led up to World War One.
Yeah, and World War Two as well, I've found in some fairly obscure classical German music, One and World War Two, there's a lot of classical music sort of built based on the Phrygian scale.
Yes.
With the, you know, the flat fifth making it more warlike and dissonant and...
Very dissonant.
Yeah.
Yes. What would you say? Would you say Flight of the Valkyries would be a good example of that?
One more question, concretely to jazz music. It would interest me because I don't know much about jazz music. But in this change between 19th and 20th century. We know that in a big picture, what was happening was the destroying of the natural societies, let's say, which were somehow separated from the power structure. So there were cultural elements which were not manufactured indeed. And these were destroyed in this, let's say, 50, 70 years, from 1850 to 1920. Till after the First World War. And somewhere in between, in the late 19th and the beginning of the 20th, there was the black music, which had several points where it was erupting, or how can I say it better? And of course it was very quickly absorbed, integrated, and consumerized, etc., but it was not so strong as today. So my question remains, was it genuine and absorbed later, or was it engineered from the beginning? That would interest me if someone wanted to say something about that.
So what you're asking if jazz particularly, or are you talking about like gospel music?
Yes, I would take that also into the broader field of jazz.
Well, they're kind of integrated, allegedly, in the history of it, they're kind of integrated at some point in the beginning. Well, it just depends. I'd say it kind of depends. It's a mixture of both, most likely. Because, take for instance, one of those Freemasons that they talk about is Louis Armstrong. And Louis Armstrong is in New Orleans around the time of the birth of jazz. Some even postulate that Louis Armstrong is one of the fathers of jazz music because he's playing in a particular band, and for some reason the name of it is escaping me at the moment, that was very popular in New Orleans at that time period, and this is how he kind of became well known as being like the greatest trumpeter in the world, but he also happened to be a Freemason. So those two kind of go hand in hand, and as popular culture, which I think is mostly, you know, 98% guided and manufactured to a certain extent, if it's not manufactured, it's being guided in a particular direction. So there could be somebody who has a genuine idea and you know, something comes along that is a genuine thing, but it's going to be corralled. It's going to be like kind of moved one way or the other. I'd say the good outside of music, the best example is when they opened up the frontier for oil drilling. And it was an old trick that was designed by Cecil Rhodes, you know, back in the diamond mines. When they opened up South Africa for anybody to go out there and mine diamonds, Cecil Rhodes' idea was, yeah, let everybody come in here and mine all the diamonds for me, and then I'll go in and I'll buy them all up.
Yeah.
It was the same thing with the oil fields with the Rockefellers. They opened up the frontier, all these wildcatter oil men go out there and get a whole bunch of oil fields and start the business, cultivate the business, and then the Rockefellers came in and bought everybody out. And if they didn't buy you out, they'd blow up your oil field, or they'd squeeze you out of business somehow and steal it anyways. So
it's like Rhodesia, you know, having a country named after you. That's quite amazing to me, I would have thought.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the Rhodes Scholarship is... Cecil Rhodes was all into Freemasonry. The Council on Foreign Relations Roundtable Group is kind of designed on...
Didn't Rhodes leave his entire fortune to the Round Suit of International Affairs or something?
Yes, he did. Absolutely.
Before you move too far away from music, it was about the time you're talking about where the frequency for the A was set at 440 hertz.
Mm-hmm.
Any comments on the significance or otherwise or insignificance of that?
That was to make Canadians feel isolated.
Was it?
That's all it was. I'm sorry. I was petulant.
Are you talking about the shift in the tone?
Yeah, so up until most people tuned an A, I think, mm-hmm. I mean, I'd be guessing at the numbers. People talk about 428 hertz, 432 hertz, and, you know, and there's other numbers. But at just before the war, the Second World War, it was set at 440, and apparently either Goebbels or Himmler or someone was a large part of the driving force behind that change.
I think that's disinformation. It was
About the change or about one of the Nazis being heavily involved?
It was all real, but it just wasn't said in an Aussie accent.
It wasn't the Nazis, I don't think. It was Tsar Nicholas. It was one of the Tsars that it changed, you know, the frequency.
So let me just ask, does anyone know the relevance of the word Tsar and the word Hussar? Because I grew up near a pub near me called the Hussar. And then when I found out about Russia and the Tsars, I often thought, is there any relevance? Anybody know any links?
Well, sometimes it's like C-Z-A-R. Sometimes it's T-S-A-R.
Yes.
Well, my understanding is that the Russian word Tsar, C-Z-A-R, is also related to Kaiser, the same as in Germany.
Phonetically, yeah.
So you like the leader of the Ashkenazi?
It's all come from... Which all come from Caesar.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
Yeah. So.
And what was the leader of the Ashkenazi called? It was called the Kagan.
The Kagan, yeah. The king, Kagan.
Kagan.
Kagan means king.
Sorry, I interrupted that.
Kagan, the leader of the Sanhedrin
is called the leader of the Sanhedrin is called the Nazi.
Springtime. I interrupted you there, mate.
Conclusion is that all music is evil. Is that the story?
I think that's the conclusion Plato came to. Did you answer Frank's question about the 440 hertz, Mahatma?
He said about Goebbels or someone...
I was also interested in whether you thought
the
idea that it causes discord to people's brains is a valid one.
I was just saying it was Tsar Nicholas, or one of the Tsars, that ordered the change to AFR 40.
It wasn't really adopted. My memory of my reading is that the U.S. didn't really adopt it until sometime in the 30s.
1926.
Oh, okay.
That early? See, I was under the impression that that all took place in the psychological years of the Nazi Party having their, you know, having their tendrils tweaked and having, you know, being informed by a lot of the eugenicists from the Western world. I didn't think it was that early. I had no idea.
Interesting, isn't it?
It does seem to be that there was a reason behind it. And I have heard the difference between the two tones, and I much prefer the natural one.
I prefer the FL40 because you can, like, on the...
You just like to antagonize.
No. What it is, like, you're playing along, and then you want to do a minor pentatonic, an aggressive minor pentatonic flourish. It's just, it fit perfectly, you know what I mean? But when you're in a actually tuning, it's not as effective. You don't want to, and you're not led to do it. You don't get the urge, you don't feel it type of thing. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Well, so which one makes the pentatonic flourish easier, the current system or the old Baroque system?
440 makes the aggressive minor pentatonic flourish more effective.
That's the current system.
Okay.
Certainly more effective, but you sort of lean towards putting that in there, if you know what I mean, just naturally. Because it fits so perfectly and be angular against the music.
Oh, so you do notice an emotional response, is what you're saying. It affects the emotion.
Yeah.
The
music.
Oh.
Yeah.
You heard it here first on Freakologist.
If I thought to use my gritted teeth.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
It's still the one I prefer. I just do. It's because I'm more accustomed to it.
In China, the tunings would change with the change of the dynasties.
Emperor, yeah.
And interestingly enough, the conversion to Western tuning took place right as the Cultural Revolution took place, which that's a very interesting thing, is that as they converted to Western tunings to accommodate...
How long was the time period between... So as a leader would die, they literally changed tone?
Yeah.
I think that shows you're there, that we've been being canoodled and fucked around with for a long, long time.
Yeah.
That proves it there. That in itself proves it to me. You haven't changed tone.
Mao Zedong introducing Western music as he allegedly moves away from the Western world. Amusing.
Right. Yeah.
Didn't Mao Zedong go to one of the... he went to one of the Western universities, didn't he? Was it Oxford or Cambridge or Harvard or something?
He went to the Yale version of... He went to the version of Yale in China.
Yeah, Yale. Yale. Yeah. That's what it's called, Frank. I'm not being funny. It's called Yale. I'm sure of it. I know.
It just says... something here.
I tell you what, Canal Street, lose the C and the S.
It said many traditional instruments underwent changes in the early to mid-20th century, which has a profound effect on the performance and sound of Chinese music, and a Western equal temperament is now used to tune most traditional instruments, which to modern ears seems less harsh, more harmonious, but which also...
MSG for the ears.
Yeah, which also robs the instruments of their traditional voices. To ears now used to hearing modern tunings, even Chinese ones, traditional tunings can sound out of tune and discordant. So yeah, this is very instrumental to social engineering.
Pun alert.
Well, certainly by the sound of it, it is anyway.
So, tell me, Mahatma, have you listened to any, is there any musical bands out there that have decided to play to the original, you know, the original resonance, or you know, decided to change, you know, what they did to 4, well, to the one that's not 4-3-2, should I say?
Not that I know of, but I think there's some, if you look on YouTube, there'll be new age type of...
Because it'd be nice to see if there's, you know, an equivalence, you know, one song played with one, because I've heard the song, and there's not much difference, but I tell you what, one puts you on edge and the other one makes you want to go to the toilet, so there's not much difference, you know, just the constant hum, but yeah, it'd be nice to see if there is, you know, an audible difference.
Online converters, but if you listen to, say, Anarchy in the UK, Sex Pistols, for instance, listen to the, actually, I think there is a video of that. There's a video of it played in FL4, Nachi one. There is a notable difference. It's much more harsh in the FL4.
Ah.
Indicates social engineering to a C. The thing is, I prefer FL4. You know, it's weird. Zed, maybe it's because that's what I got accustomed to.
You learn to love your captivator. Sorry.
Like, not all classical music is... I don't think Astor Piazzolla social engineering in any way. I mean, it was mainly tangos and stuff like that, but it's... he played a bandolin and wrote for a bandolin, but you play it on the guitar, it's really difficult to play. And there's some really dissonant stuff for a fraction of a... You know what I mean? And then it goes back to the normal.
Well, do you know what? There's a thing that there's a thing about old art and old music. When I say classical music, I mean, I don't say old music, I mean classical music. And it seems like the talent was spotted at a very early age. I mean, it seems like the people who run the place, and I'd use that term loosely, so don't want anybody taking on it, blew the load. They had so much talent with the classical music and the classical art. And nowadays, we see how easy people are swayed, you know, with just the mundane, you know, and how it's packaged and, you know, what you know, people got a backstory. In we're going back a couple of hundred years, whether or not Mozart was a school of learning, a school of teaching music and, you know, and obviously a factory of music, it's still inspired. And it seems to me that they know now, they don't need to. They, again, so I'm saying they again, they don't need that much talent to perpetrate a hoax, if you know what I mean. Does that make sense to people now? It seems to have died off, the correlation of talent out there seems to have died off with the telecommunications, I suppose you could call it. But having said that, there was still a crossover point in the 40s and 50s where swing music stopped from being played by bands to being played by just records in halls, music halls, and that was when this whole cultural thing took off. So the people still were striving to hear these things, but it was made more, what's the word, more mobile, more easier for them to listen to. They didn't, you know, you'd have to wait for a band to set up. You know what I mean?
Well, I'm not sure about the US or other European countries, but in the UK, skiffle was a massive thing before rock and roll.
Yes, it was.
There was loads of people in their front rooms playing skiffle, washboards and in rhythms and skiffle. Yes, it's a rock and roll.
Skiffle was, kind of a trend over there, right? Like a big one for a while.
People could get the instruments needed fairly inexpensive and just jam out in the front room when they had a drink, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know,
And also, there was a piano in everyone's room.
Mm-hmm.
Come round and do the bit on piano and sing their song. Or just stand there and sing a song that they sung. And people would enjoy each other's, you know, it was all DIY as you can get.
which I think is what we're striving to try and achieve tonight. Everybody pop in, do their bit.
It's still in countries like, maybe down south in Wales, I'm not sure I'm in the north, but like, I've been over there and stayed with some people, and everyone sings us on the Saturday night, we all have a drink. People sing their song quiet because we're not used to that culture. We don't sing those songs anymore, you know what I mean? But they still do. Things with gusto. Fucking great. Yeah.
Isn't it funny how hard it is to kill the musical heritage that runs through people? I know we were talking about classical music, and I believe it's attached to academia, but nevertheless, there's still... If you used to grow up with a father who's playing an instrument in the corner of the pub, or, you know, whatever it may be, you are going to grab that at an early age, just exactly the same way as you'll grab his pipe, his glasses, his pipe knife, you know, whatever it may be. You're going to go for that thing because you're going to try and emulate the person you love. So the abstraction, when they take these things now and they highlight them, actually, it does take away from the classical side of things, because classical music was put on a pedestal, when in actual fact, music is music. If it's coming from your heart, and if you know, you're from a family who plays music, then obviously you've got a lot of interest in music. When they classicalize it, obviously that's just a way of branding things. And I think the way they attached it to the universities and stuff like that, and academia in general, and you know, the prestige. There's the prestige involved in it nowadays, which I'm not familiar with. And it all comes back to watching Deliverance when I was a young lad. And that doesn't mean I was accosted. But I watched Deliverance as a young lad, and I seen that lad playing that banjo or guitar or ukulele. And it was amazing. It was amazing. And once you realise that, you know, the people that are in these orchestras, they're not from the academic background. 9 times out of 10, you know, they're from, what's the word? Working class backgrounds. You know,
a lot of the musicians appear to be from educated backgrounds and that.
A lot of them are, but I mean, the majority, you know, the filler. You know what I mean? Like Tiger Woods, obviously. Trained to be a golfer, but nevertheless, he probably would have been able to play golf pretty good anyway. Not honed, but you see these people getting on and off buses with big instruments, traveling through rain, and they're carrying it with them every time. They're not even going to music class yet until the end of the day, through the end of the working day, and they're still carrying it with them. I don't know if there's some sort of subsidy paid, but I'll tell you what, the commitment to playing it and the enjoyment you get out of it, and not only that, but what you actually produce in itself, I think we'd all agree that it's a thing of beauty.
Yeah, I'm not going to apologise to anyone for being in love with music.
Yeah, no.
You know what I mean? That music belongs to me and fuck everyone else.
I still remember the first time I heard Smokey Robinson. How about that? Mid-80s, first time you heard Smokey. Brilliant.
What was he singing?
Oh, we had the Platoon soundtrack, and then straight after that, I went the best hits of Smokey Robinson, and after that, you started falling in love with every other soul singer going. But remember, I'm 40. I'm still young in the music world. You know, I'm still seduced by pop charts and
the first one pop I ever heard by him was...
Tracks of My Tears.
Tears of a Clown.
That's right.
And there's no one around.
Mm-hmm.
But I tell you what, that is a wonderful lyric. Now, if there's a smile on my face, it's only there trying to fool the public. But when it comes down to fooling you, now, honey, that's quite a different subject. Don't let my sad expression give you the wrong impression. Really, I'm sad. That's not for idiots.
That I'm sure that got plenty of play in the clubs in Britain, Northern Soul.
You know what?
That's got the good Northern Soul beat. You know, I was going to read this here real quick. Going back to classical, Wagner, you know, Wagner was a
Wagner was the Stalinist of all of them.
Yes, absolutely. He was political. He was a political artist. So if you think of we think of radical revolutionary musicians nowadays, that's what Wagner was for the time period, and he was hell bent. There's even a quote here where he's hell bent on the destruction of society. He says, he wrote violent tracks, quote, "I will destroy the existing order of things. So up ye peoples of the earth, up ye oppressed, up ye poor." He came up with a concept of unified artwork. Maybe my German is terrible, but I guess it's like Gesamtkunstwerk, like a unified theory of art.
It's Gesamtkunstwerk.
Okay, yeah, see, told you I was bad. And he decided that all great art must be based on mythology. As early as 1844, he was writing, "It is the province of the present-day dramatist to give expressive and spiritual meaning to the material interests of our own time. But to the operatic poet and composer falls the task of conjuring up the holy spirits of poetry as it comes to us in the sagas and legends of past ages." He wrote that God and gods are the first creations of man's poetic force. Myth, then, was the ideal stuff which poetry was made. It was necessary to go to a pre-Christian period, for Christianity had diluted the mythos. Through the adoption of Christianity, the folk had lost all true understanding of their original vital relations of the mythos. And so he had to create a new speech, which he decided the poet must use Stabrime, which resembles the poetry found in the sagas. This is a highly alliterative kind of poetry, the kinship of vowel sounds. And so, anyways, it goes through how this poetry worked. So he was like, just like Schoenberg later, you know, this was an overthrow of the existing things to basically confuse people to a certain extent and to liberate them. He also wrote the opera Tristan and Isolde, and it seems for the time period this was a pretty racy opera. He did it talks, there's a whole, this book is just kind of a brief history of composers, but so there's another example of people being cognitively aware of the influence of music on the general public, on people using music, revolutionary tool. So it's not, I don't think it's a bad thing to question, exactly, what you're listening to or what you're into, or question the validity of your favorite superstar, your favorite guitar player, your favorite rap artist, whatever it is. You got to go in and see where they're coming from.
You're listening to another hour of Fakeologist Audio Chat on Fakeologist.com.
That was the new bumper. Is it Hitchcock?
Yeah, I looked into my favorite rapper and found that his grandma was connected to the P2 Lodge and the CIA and major propaganda agent, and I kind of had a feeling that that's what his role was, and it does seem like it's a family thing, these positions of social change.
And who was it?
His name is Cool with a K, A D, A period D period. But yeah, his grandmother's Claire Sterling. She came up with the Bulgarian connection. along with Paul Hens of he's majorly connected to P2 as well.
Interesting.
Yeah, the Bulgarian connection was a theory put forth by the CIA of blaming Russia for the assassination attempt on the Pope.
So, I understand that the term that you always bring into the discussion, John, social engineering, if we just take it as a term and not with all the theory that it has happened always. It is just how the things work. There are some special elements, we could call them elites of any kind. They are not in all the times the same. If we now take history as given, as the mainstream narrative, there are historical periods where elites are defined other than by owning many things and defining the priorities, war and business, something like that. In our latest two centuries, that applies also, but there has been a very grave change in the beginning of the 20th century. And if we take music as one of the products of that era, we see that it is also very important that we have the generation of, I mean, the production of the technology for film and the production of the technology for conservation of sound. And this goes parallel with the evolution, let's say, of the industry of entertainment. The word did not exist in the beginning of the 20th century, maybe, but we call it today like that. So we have a total destruction of all socially immanent, centers where communication, music, relationships and such things were produced earlier. And this comes into the hands of even fewer people. This happens between 19 and 1920, maybe even 1930. We have then also color film and the music industry that is created. So I, from my point of view, would not say that till the 30s we can call it really social engineering. It is still very controversial in the space of the social bodus, let's say, the social body, but it is not clear in which direction it goes. And very clearly we can see it after the end of Second, but maybe during the First World War it was even decided, but the results came later. So I don't know, what do you think of that?
Well, was the French Revolution socially engineered?
You know, that's a problem, because if we talk of social engineering, that means that there is a clearly defined subject. It's a group or 10 groups that doesn't make a difference. If that is the definition, then no, it was not. It was an antagonistic society with different, very different and not clear strategies of survival, of techniques for the survival, which were in a competition, let's say, or antagonism is better.
Do you think the French Revolution was fomented by revolutionary Freemasonic forces?
Let me look up that word. Fomented?
Fomented. Created.
Created. Or guided.
Kickstarted.
Kickstarted, okay. You know,
just
from...
cursory inspection, the French Revolution was Masonic from the get-go.
Yes. There's mainstream books written about that. Yeah, absolutely. The reason I was asking that is because if you look at it from the perspective that that cultures can be guided into a particular, we can even use the term fakery, because you're faking the public out in a certain sense, because you're promising them something, but then it's really for the purpose of something else, right? So even as far back as the French Revolution, there was, the positivist religion. It is a religion of positivism, social science, right? So it was the beginning of social engineering, because that was kind of that's where you get social science from, was from that idea that you would have a new religion of science, and it was going to mostly be focused on, basically, for lack of a better word, keeping people in line. The idea of social sciences are still, of course,
anthropologists were called anthropologists.
Yes.
Yeah. Mahatma. Yes.
Yeah.
No, he was just making a remark. He's anthropology.
You know, the topic of Freemasonry as a factory is absolutely new for me. Really? As I have never considered that earlier. And even now, where I have some really absolutely basic knowledge of it, that it existed, etc., and exists, I am not sure if this is not a mythology that wants to explain something as a very important factor of historical progress or movement, let's say, because we are not sure, maybe it's not progress, but the opposite. And now if you ask me about the French Revolution, briefly, that's what I remember from school.
Mism, I'm going to interrupt you there, because
yes,
what is progress?
A progress is if the things become better, and I don't think they have become better.
Things were better when we were tribal.
I think it is good when humankind has technologies and can make survival and life and spiritual life even better. But this is not the case. We see destruction. We see bad things going on. We see.
I'm going to disagree with you there, but only from the fakeologist point of view. I understand where you're coming from. I'm going to disagree with you on the whole, and that we see destruction all over the place. Because I really do think that if the atrocities were going on in the world as we're being told, the people would turn around and revolt. I really do believe that. I believe we're being tricked with subterfuge and media fakery and hyper-realistic drills, shade is real, and false flags, and all a cacophony, different tricks they're using. And it follows on to my same argument for the Holocaust. You've got 30,000.
You know, the thing with the fakery is one aspect of this, what I call, it is not better, this is worse. Because if you see the facts of an average family today, which is between 25 maybe and 30, 40, they have a very hard life in comparison to the life of our parents in the 50s and 60s. In the first world, I'm speaking of Europe and the States and Canada and what's called the first world. And in the rest of the world, we see the rising areas which do the same destruction of environment that the first world already did, with cars, with, I don't know, all this thing. So I don't really believe it's better.
Hear, hear. I think all this stuff is just going backwards.
What do you mean by that, Frank?
I think all of the what we call progress is regression.
I haven't thought about that.
Well, you know, to me, every time you bulldoze a beautiful tropic island into the sea, or cut down a tree, or build another road, you're just making the world more stupid, more unenjoyable.
Yes, I see what you mean. I do not have a really grounded, or how is it said, good-based opinion. I have only a very surface opinion, let's say. And it goes like that. I think that between 1850, very rudimentary, I say it now, maybe it's 1860 or 1840, and 1950, many things happened with which the normal human being could not catch up as fast as those who were in the decision positions of the new products, of the new technologies, of the new weapons, of the new production material, of new factories, of new pseudosciences, etc. And that this one would be, in my opinion, what we have to change. Otherwise, I don't think it's bad. It could be good, yes, but not with these people who make the decisions. To come back to what I wanted to ask earlier, after that what John told us, Freemasonry and French Revolution. Yes, sure, it was a factor, but I am not sure that it was just a factor who won the game, the play, in that period, and then it became strong, or if others suspect it was even before, and it induced and engineered the revolution. I cannot believe that with the material I have to now. I have to go into it more. But my feeling is that because of the knowledge of the period as a whole, that the Freemasonry was one aspect of the antagonistic parts in that period. We have the church who became secularized, the religion that became secularized, and we have rising of new, more rational, more secularized ideas as science, as, masonry,
so
possibly.
So you don't think there's any conspiring behind the scenes to kind of direct society in a particular way between any one or two or three, and that for the most part we get it's an age old game that's played. It's called Order Out of Chaos. So you create the chaos and then you come along and you fix it for everybody after you're the one who created the chaos, right?
Yes.
So, but this, in a sense, is, if you want to get technical about the term social engineering, I guess there wasn't technically the word or the idea in the particularate of social engineering, but in a sense, it's pretty much, you know, like we were talking about the other day with Plato, it's as old as, you know, Republic.
Yes, yes, that's true. Yes, yes. I understood that.
Deciding what's best for the people making a decision in a closed room behind closed doors, and then coming to the conclusion that through secret methods, you are going to manipulate what you want.
But you look,
Using the guise of something else, you're actually going to use that something else as a vehicle to get what you want out of it. So you're tricking, you know, you're tricking the public. I trip you on the street, and when you trip, I steal your wallet, but yet at the same time that I've stolen your wallet, I'm reaching my hand out and helping you up. And then you walk away thinking I was a nice man who helped you, and actually I tripped you to steal your wallet.
Is that why you're saying to sell in oils?
I didn't get it.
Yeah, John sells the most finest essential oils, which alleviate all illnesses. I've tried one in the past, but I'll be honest with you, not one of yours, but a few other people's, and that's sleeping. There's some marvelous ones for sleeping. So if anyone out there has a rough night's sleep,
mostly,
and also for waking up.
Mostly I just use them for pouring on the ground so people, when they slip on them, then I can
steal a little wallet.
But, let's take Plato.
Oh, sorry, Miz, before we start there, I left, I didn't mean to leave, I was kicked out by life. All I was going to say there, progress to me is efficiency for the government. That's all that means to me nowadays. Progress means efficiency for the government. That, you know, on a basic level, that's the way I see it now. So that's all I meant to interject with. Sorry for interrupting you.
Yes, okay. Concerning Plato, and given that he existed in the time that is told that he existed, I say that only because I have some questions about the chronology. But as the narrative is, Plato was a child of the great Marathon War that happened in that period. And after the war, when everything was destroyed, I don't have yet now concrete, you know, dates, etc. It's a long time ago that I was reading about this. After the war, he decided to spend his life by reflecting about how could life be without war. That was his motivation. And he bought, that's the mythology, he bought an acre outside of Athens, and he wrote on the entrance of that door, nobody shall come in who is not willing to become a lover of geometry. It is said, the founding of the Western idealism. So, of course, we can say Plato was also a social engineer, but his intention was reflection about society. And it is also said, or he is criticized as an aristocrat, because in his ideal society, there are all these categories. There are the aristocrats, there are the not aristocrats, there are the workers, and the women are completely not existent in the society, and there are slaves. You know, that's all this is also a fact, but he has an idealistic aspect. So there is no intention, for example, which can be criticized.
Add, I would agree that most people who are idealists in the present day included, they believe that whatever it is that they're doing, whatever culture or situations or whatever it may be, that they are manufacturing into existence is for the of society. There are people, not good people, involved in this, and they're involved in corruption, all sorts of things, and that type of stuff as well. But whatever it may be, if you're an idealist, you think your way's the best way, and if you're socially engineering people or manipulating people to think is best, it's probably because you think that best one runs smoothly. Plato specifically talks about music as being able to cast a spell over. That's an interesting thing, too. I don't think it gets considered often enough, maybe not even considered that much at all.
He was also against written language, and he hated all arts. He thought arts were a distraction from the human ability and the human soul and such things. You know, I don't say I agree with Plato, I just wanted to... We have now 3 points to compare. We have Plato, we have the Freemasons in the French Revolution, and we have jazz music and the modern creation of consumerism and industrialized entertainment. Something like that.
Maybe we're all talking about the same thing.
Yes.
It could all be connected. He said that Plato says no one's allowed in here who doesn't love geometry. That's kind of interesting that the Freemasonic G stands for geometry, the creed of a secret society, which I wouldn't doubt.
It's a coincidence.
Another thing is, I just wanted to mention this real quick. Another thing that doesn't get scrutinized would be Plato's telling us the story of Socrates, and Socrates is on trial for trying to change the youth, for trying to basically he's turning the youth against the parent, and so
he's known for his giving up. He did not stand for his own word. He drank the conium.
Mm-hmm. But a lot of people, I'm not saying you, but people who just in general read philosophy are kind of taught that, well, Socrates was a good guy and people, thought he was bad but he may have been a guy who was a revolutionary trying to cause a change, a shift. And I'm just saying within the story, we don't even know that these guys were even real dudes. Mm-hmm. But if we're taking the context of the regular person out there, taking a philosophy class, they think these guys existed. So, yes, Socrates, in that sense, was trying to change the youth and turn them against the previous generation is another thing we see over and over again. Especially when it comes to in our modern day with music and revolutions and like I was saying, the music, especially in the 20th century, and like you were correctly pointing out with entertainment, to go into entertainment, be captured. It is a consumer, the concept of entertainment is a product of the 20th century, no doubt, but I'd say generally speaking, entertainment is something that is innate in humans, but it's unfortunately at this point a weakness that's good. Like Mahatma was saying, he loves music. I love music too. But if you're not consciously aware, it'd be something that's innate to, or just entertainment in general, it's something that you love just by being human, but it's something that can be weaponized.
What sort of love is it you have for music, John? Is it agape, stog, eros, or philia?
It is... Oh, you asked me this before. It's Filio. Yeah.
Yes. I would still see a difference in what we are saying, that if I understand you right, I think in your interpretation of the, let's say, what is the driving energy or the driving force in societies during time? And I think from my point of view, the possibility that there is some conspiratory force is not plausible. It's not plausible with Plato, it's not plausible with the French Revolution, but it becomes very plausible after this two centuries, 1990-1920, when very, very many of the important parameter, the first world, become very centralized. Centralized, industrialized, and very easy to manage. So from my point of view, it is an effect of a too fast evolvement of technology and a too slow adaptation for the population, let's say.
So wouldn't you argue that it's then imprisoning us, Muslim, if the, you know, it's the technology and the way it's come about has gone, I would argue, much more quickly than our ability to escape from it?
Yeah, something like that, yeah. And in those, if we stay with that example, the one who has the food for the camel profits. He profits more than me, who has to run next to, after the camel and after the, him who has the. Yeah, I can't tell it better. It's for me, the destructive situation in which society is has a reason in his own. Is not because there is a really grave evil metaphysical energy from Freemasons or from Khazarian. I don't know. Of course they exist. I do not say they don't exist. And of course they conspirate. But it's not that what is the reason for this momentum in history.
So you think the momentum comes from a kind of evolution? Do you sort of it's arisen from nothing?
I didn't understand that, Frank, sorry.
Okay, so you're, from what I understand, the way I'm interpreting what you're saying is that you have the view that this prism we're creating at such great speed is just a natural consequence of, you know, the way we are, rather than some direction driving that, some intelligent direction to imprison us.
No, I don't think there is anything natural about it, because technology is not natural. Technology is...
So you do think there is an intelligence driving the imprisonment?
No, I think it is it has a reason, or many reasons. I mean, it is interpretable, it is understandable, it is knowledgeable, and it has to be knowledged. That's what I say. It is, and it is the main reason I see is the gap between fast track technology and a natural motion of the human being. And
question.
Yes.
On that note, that point you just made right there. Mm-hmm. When was
sorry, 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 John, was the pun intended?
When was the idea for the Industrial Revolution fermented? Don't you think there's an illogical leap from the Enlightenment to the dawn of the Industrial Revolution? Or do you think that's a completely logical time span right there?
If I understand you correctly, I'm not sure, but that was not an enlightenment. That was not that was not a moment in history and then everything changed. That started in the 13th century. It had a very compact century between 1500 and 1600 again.
So
it became
just real quick, because the baby woke up and I wanted to hear.
I'm sorry.
Do you see a linear progression? Because I don't see technically a logical progression. I see kind of illogic, and that's what you see with quote unquote progress when it's being fomented behind the scenes. You see these steps that kind of manifest in a faster pace than they would in like kind of natural society. And that's what you see from that time period on up to the present day, is these illogical leaps in technology and advancement. And they have a linear progression, but they're not linear in the sense of how something would progress naturally.
Shall we wait till you come back, John?
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay. There are many questions. First is that about the linear. History is not linear. We can see there are always very many parameters, many interests, different interests, antagonism, hunger periods, bad weather, and I don't know, thousands of things. But there are concrete points in history where technology makes grave big paces. Is that understandable? One such
strides, Mism. Strides is the word
strides.
To use that.
Okay.
Makes great strides.
Okay, yes. And I think around those moments when such a thing happens, as is, for example, the internet also, the digital technology, which started very early in the 19th century. When I say progressed, I don't mean something that becomes better in this context. I just say it evolves, but not in a positive. I have not a better word.
Palatable. Palatable.
No,
it's easier to swallow.
No,
efficient.
It comes even more to his immanent potential, something like that. So we have digital, let's take digital technology. You have some guys that structure the language in the beginning of the last century. They make the communicative patterns, then the others, the linguists and the philosophers, and then come the mathematicians, and they formulate the language, the binary language, somewhere in the 30s, and it progresses in that direction, which is immanent in this mindset, we must say.
Well, let me put it another way, Mr. Mark. In Chinese, what would you call it, philosophy that I read as a child, is that the Chinese would talk about how the events of now are simply the unfolding of the seeds sown in the past. Now, I guess to me, it doesn't seem in many respects that we see that kind of unfolding of seeds sown in the past. We often see seeds snuffed out and whole new ones planted in there. I mean, I'm thinking, what's an example? Say the trolley cars in the USA, where they had all these amazing public transport systems, and they all just got ripped out. And cars were put in place and roads, which are all just totally hopeless and impractical. So we don't seem to see what I would call that natural unfolding that this Chinese philosophy that I think talks about. And I'm trying to get a feel from you about what you think is driving the unnatural, if you like, step changes. For example, like the streetcars and the
Well, so before you go any further, I'm just going to interject there. That's exactly the same as people nowadays still using petrol. you know, I mean, I live in Manchester, Frank. We were a tram sire 100 years ago, and we were for probably 50 years before that. And then all of a sudden, 1928, beginning of the war, things started dying down. Before you know it, boom, we're all on cars by the late 60s. But it's exactly the same. They're just, what they're making money out of, they seem to turn away from. Every time. And the electricity, you know, they wanted to charge people. They couldn't. Imagine the tariff of a tram and people getting on paying a couple of pennies. And then the tariff of the house, they couldn't do that. So they have to take the electricity out of the mainstream and put it in there. And it seems to me they always attack. I'm going to stop now. They always attack the thing that used to work. You know, straight off the bat, it works. And then they attack it like diesel ships. Anyway, yes. That's me.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's there seems to be a determination to stop the natural order rather than allow it to.
Why, Frank? Why do we need to go in this abstract sphere? We have in the middle of the 19th century, we have the not invention, but finding and processing of caoutchouc. And that enables the interested parts, that is the industrialists, which were beginning to become powerful, the production of cars. But it needs also that people buy the cars. You know, it's not natural, but nothing is natural since we speak. Everything is technology since we are human beings. You know what I mean? I don't see the reason why we should go in a sphere where we would suspect that there is a conspiration since 12,000 years to destroy humanity. I don't see that. We are here and we are human and we can react. And maybe that's my...
So what I'm trying to get at is, what is the motivation of those people to do that?
Those with the cars.
Yes, so what's their motivation?
Money? Power? Simple.
And why are those things attractive to those people?
That's another discussion. That's not the discussion that drives history. That's the discussion what drives human beings to be possessive to have pleasure.
The people that run the place are still inspired by the same stuff that inspires the people that don't run the place.
Yes, my view of the
chain of the discussion we've had so far is we've got to this point here where we're saying, okay, that the destructive changes that are taking place are driven by people that want money and power. And so the logical next step of this conversation should be, why do those people want money and power? Because that's the key then, isn't it? If we understand what the motivations of these people are, then it allows us to take defensive actions.
Yes. Mahatma.
Refuge.
Referral is everything.
Refuge. Refuge, Frank.
Refuge from what?
From whatever miss, whatever they've done.
And what have they done?
Exactly. They're seduced by one thing to do one thing, and then after that they say they offer them refuge. And once you're in, you're in. I think that's the first step. I have no idea what the second one is. But that is the bridge between the lower level and the upper level.
Aren't we kind of all herd animals? And so wouldn't maybe these...
How did you sneak in with them pants on?
Well, I mean, if you think about it, if you're part of this inner circle, wouldn't you always strive to kind of be in that inner circle once you get to that level of being wealthy and powerful? Isn't there, like, probably an inner circle of people that they would want to be part of?
I guess I just don't accept the idea that people, humans like you, for example, like me, are willing to do simply for money and power, to just the complete bastardy that goes on. That doesn't make sense.
Looking for refuge.
I don't understand what doesn't make sense. Like, obviously money and power corrupts people. I mean, don't you meet people in your life that you grew up with, and as they've become more wealthy or whatever, their almost code of ethics or whatever it is isn't the same?
My personal experience has been kind of like the opposite of that, but yeah, so... the people I'm coming into contact now with people that were, you know, verging on complete bastardry as they're young, and they're quite successful now, and being more about contributing. You know, you get to a certain time in your life where you want to return, where you want to contribute to the world. And I'm you know, particularly people sort of 50 plus. I think that's.
Is it for selfish reasons, or is that because they've done something maybe wrong and they feel like they need to get, like, they need to, you know what I'm saying? Like, I don't know. My experience is
let me put it another way. Whatever their motivations, I don't see within them, but this continuing need to lust for power and money. Perhaps you meet different people.
I guess I'm not really fully understanding what you're just saying, that you don't think people have the desire for power and money?
Not to the extent where they're prepared to do things which cause harm and misery to the rest of humanity, no. Quite the reverse.
I don't know if I would agree with that with everybody.
Okay. And obviously it's not true of everybody, because we're not observing that. And my question to Mism was, what does she think is driving the people that obviously are interested in money and power to that particular way of living?
Frank, you mentioned earlier the Chinese, if I remember.
It's just that the unfolding of, so that idea is that whatever we have at the present and what's going to happen next is already been set in motion. We can't change the sort of immediate short-term future. That what's happening now is the unfolding of seeds sown in the past.
Yes, that is true. Yes, I remember something else from the Chinese philosophy. I think it's Lao Tse or something like that. The meaning of the ruler is to look for the good of the people. Something like that. I don't remember the whole phrase. And let's take it just as I've articulated it now. I cannot find it at the moment. This is completely out of control since minimum 100 years, 120 maybe. But it is not out of control because there is a genuine evil in some subjects, or that's my opinion, or some great conspiracy over centuries or millions of years. It is out of control because those who had the chance to concentrate power, concentrate technologies, concentrate decision positions, are absolutely not those who can stop the machine, which they have created with the help of us, of course. There were many chances in the last century for, let's say, reduction of the negative effects of this massive technologization, etc.
Yes, so effectively now your view is that what's going on now has taken on a life of its own independent of the source of creation. Is that right? Let's not use a life. Let's use a momentum and a systematization of its principles, that now the endless, for want of a better word, technological forward thrust is now unstoppable. Is that your view?
No, my view is not it is unstoppable. My view is also not that it is not natural. There is nothing natural after intrinsic technology. So everything is natural in a way, or everything is technology in a way, in some way. What I don't want to accept, maybe it is true, and I do just not accept it because it makes me helpless. That's the main reason. I do not want to accept that there is some kind of instance that controls all the things, and I mean really all the things, and that this machine is unstoppable. I accept that there are really very bad and maybe even evil people in some positions, and with all this stuff that we were speaking earlier also, but I don't believe that that this has something to do with something metaphysical. Just the nature of power, the nature of concentration of power, and the situation in which we are as the population, let's say, which is too slow, cannot react, cannot catch up.
I accept that you don't want to believe it, and that's fine. But my
I don't want to believe it.
My question to you is the current predicament consistent with the possibility that there is a devil running the planet?
There is no devil running the planet, Frank. I'm sure of that.
I understand your view. I understand what you think. That's fine.
No, I'm sure of that. I don't have any question about devil and such things.
But what is it that makes you absolutely sure that what the things that we've discussed, and we've got to this point now where we're trying to understand the motivation of the people that are concentrating power to the detriment of the hoi polloi? What is the motivation of that entity if it's not devilry?
I don't know if I understood you correctly.
Why does it have to be motivated on something like devils? Or I think about it. If you have like a certain way that you live your life, and say it's higher than everyone else, don't you want to maintain that and always reach higher than that? Isn't that kind of like the human? Maybe it's not. I don't know. Maybe, obviously, it's not for everyone. But isn't that maybe when those people are at that level, they want to just keep and continually climb, and they don't care who they have to step over to get there? You know what I'm saying? I think that's like, I don't know how you haven't come across people like that. You know, like, and I don't think that's they're devil worshippers or there's like a devil entity they worship. I just think literally it's for selfish reasons. I think people get very selfish. You know, and I mean, when you have something, you don't want to give it up.
Yeah, no, I agree that people get very selfish, but do they then continue to act in a way which is clearly detrimental to all of us, to the rest of us?
No, they find religion, like Christianity or whatever, and they use that as an excuse to feel better about themselves and oppress other people. I mean, it's kind of like my experience of observations of people. Hasn't that been yours?
Well, I think I've told you my general experience is that, you know, you see people that start off in quite young age, but, you know, by the time they get to my age, that's not the way they're operating.
Yeah, I have a friend, and her son is, he's only 6 months old, but, I'm sorry, 6 months, he's a year old now, and there's a 6 month baby that they're in daycare with. And my friend's son is, like, very, like, mean towards that other baby, like, to the point where, like, has scratched the baby's face, you know, has hit the baby and my friend's, like, a very sweet person. And I'm not saying that their child's evil or the devil or anything, but I'm just saying, like, I mean, is that not an example of behavior that is not nice, right? And isn't that kind of support the fact that people just do things just to be not nice?
Well, some people might argue it's because that child has the devil in it.
Oh, come on. I know that the child does not have the devil in them.
That's too easy, Frank.
Well, okay, so again, I understand what you were saying. I mean, I am really disappointed.
Have you met a devil to know that their devil exists?
The point I'm making is the model consistent with what we observe? That's all I'm asking.
And I guess I'm not seeing what the model is that you're...
The biblical model is simply that since the fall, of Adam, from the, you know, the being thrown out from the garden, that the devil is the prince of the world.
You're listening to another hour of Fakeologist Audio Chat on Fakeologist.com.
That's the first time I've heard Abs new. That's the first time I heard that.
Did you like that? What's choose for now?
Yeah, I mean, it's cool. I like the change.
Thanks to Veloset for that. Appreciate that, Veloset. He did that. I asked him to do a bumper for himself, and he decided to do that instead. So
I like your original one too. I thought that one was pretty good too.
Yeah, it's pretty good. We're always looking for help.
Back to what you guys were just discussing, just to continue, it's a great conversation. But I'm sorry because that whole thing happened, but I think you were saying about Adam and Eve and being thrown out of the Garden of Eden, right? And then can you just continue what you were saying there? I kind of lost at that point.
Okay, so at the moment we've had a discussion where we get to a point where we acknowledge that, if you like, the mechanization of the planet is exceeding the ability of humans to adapt to it, and we're kind of getting trapped into it. So we really have got two possibilities. One is that the current situation is a result of just the playing out of the various triggers and responses that people have and the organizations in place, okay, and that it's just it's going to continue on simply because the structures are in place that they have a kind of organizational motivation that's unstoppable, if you like. And so would you agree that that's the current model, that the one that you would accept?
No.
Yeah, okay. I don't think so either.
So what would you describe, I'm asking then, what is your model to explain the zeitgeist, the spirit in the machine? What's the ghost in the machine that's driving our current way of life?
Vote for truth? You first.
It's all out of selfishness is what I think it is. I know religion would probably classify that as the devil or something, but I think it's out of our own selfishness. Like, people want to feel important. People want to feel like they're part of a group. People want certain things, and they'll do it at whatever cost they can do it. I don't know. I feel like it's our own selfishness is probably why things are the way they are and why things are maybe controlled. I don't understand. The only thing you had said that I initially didn't agree with was you said that we have the inability to adapt. I don't understand what you mean by that, I guess, but...
Well, I guess I'm really saying that what's going on at the moment seems to be...
What is going on at the moment? That's what
Out of control of the common man, of the hoi polloi. We don't seem to have the mechanism for me to... say, like, apparently in Switzerland, you can... If I say, yeah, I'm not really happy about allowing homosexual marriage, I can start a petition, and if I can get enough signatures, that petition can go to a vote in Switzerland, and there's some kind of participatory democracy. So in Switzerland, there seems to be at least some ability to start pulling levers. But in my country, there seems to be no ability for me to pull any levers. Everything seems to be not in my control. And what I'm trying to...
Do you feel out of control because you have no... because of the marriage? And I don't understand what's out of your control.
All of the changes that are occurring, like we're using petrol, and we're going to shut down our power stations. What else are we going to do? We're going to build more and more roads. We're going to have people live on one side of the city and drive to a job on the other side of the city. Everything is kind of nonsensical and stupid. And there doesn't seem to be any ability to wind back, I guess, and live the way, say, the Mennonites live.
Paul, did you go to a Mennonite community and live like a Mennonite?
Right, I'm going to be dead honest with you now, right? Right. Take a step back from what you're saying there, Frank.
Yeah.
And why are the people doing this? How did they manage to do this? How did they manage to control things? How did they manage to do these things? Let's think of it this way. Let's just say a human, a normal human, expels a certain amount of energy to keep them content, happy, whatever it may be. Doesn't matter, whatever it is to keep them content. So the same amount of stimulation, right? So if you stimulate a crowd enough, you can control them without even having to do anything. I know you sort of understand what I'm saying, but you stimulate them enough, the result doesn't matter. Because they're going to be stimulated enough. Just like if you were having sex and you have an orgasm, And then obviously you can do what you want for the next 20 minutes, but nothing's going to happen. Same with that. If you stimulate a crowd or stimulate a group of people, whether it's hunting, fashion, you know, whatever it may be, once you've done that, that can take their zeal. So
your view is it's still people that's driving the machine at the moment, Napoleon?
No. The tools that are being used to perpetrate this big hoax, which is what it is, have been used for a long time, and that's what made me laugh when I was listening to John saying they changed the tone once the Chinese emperor died. That just made me think, yeah, that makes perfect sense. Tried and tested skills, and it's the same with politics.
So was it the machine that orchestrated the 9/11 events, or was it people?
I think that was just a birthday card.
What is the machine?
That was a birthday card to the Rothschilds. Just a birthday card, nothing else. Well, relinquishing the power. Next level now.
Well, it was symbolic, right?
Who was creating the symbol, one truth or now? Was it the machine, or was it someone?
It seems to be humans.
Okay, so your view is
an emotional attachment to these numbers and these, you know, 11s and 7s and, you know, the numbers we constantly see.
So your view is that humans are still in charge of the machine, is that right?
I guess who else would be in charge? I guess I'm not identifying any other species other than humans that are around to do this.
Okay, so Misson, what's your view? Are humans in charge of the machine, or is the machine in charge of the humans?
But what is the machine? I don't understand. Is there a machine? Is that like an android of some sort? Like
No. I think, or just say it yourself, Frank. I think you mean the pattern of the society we have. How is power structured? How are decisions made? How are the communities organized? This all, that very complex system of almost dissolved nation states and many powers in the corporate states, etc. All this is the machine. We are part of it. It's just an example.
Yes,
it's just
definitely. I agree with them. But there's a bigger machine above the one that controls the system.
Yeah, where are the signs for that? I don't see that.
Is it?
Exactly. So that must run on a different schedule. That is not based on monetary value. It can't be.
It can't be
backed by position of power either. Mm. Because if it was by position of power, then the people who were running it there would be power structures. There's not. There'd be power struggles. There's not.
There are power struggles.
I disagree.
The elite is in a great, this elite, not the good elite, the best elite, the decision makers are in a fight since 50 years.
I disagree so much. How much we have evolved in the past 300 years, right? It is amazing. From paintings to art to architecture to discovering space flight, even though I don't believe in space, all these things. Whether or not the technology was already known, it was disseminated and acted upon very quickly.
Let's take the space travel. It's a good example.
Yes.
From my point of view, I believe that an elite that is in a situation to need to reign with such massive fraud and to try to maintain their powers with that kind of betrayals and insinuations and how the names are, is in a grave conflict. I believe
isn't that what they've had to do for the past couple of hundred years? They've had to manifest it on big battlefields before they were able to contain it.
So you believe, just to understand it correctly, do you believe that, let's take the last 500 years, would that be okay? Because we have more information about it. Do you believe that it is a constantly the same power structure the last 500 years which makes the decision?
I think you might be onto something what you're saying when you say that that the elites might be. What did you say? You were saying that they're not agreeing, right? And I think you can see that, like you said, when you study history, look at the rise and fall of currencies.
You know, that was a
group of elite people that, like...
Can I just say something? You do not spit on your bank manager, okay? There you go.
What does that mean? I didn't understand.
You do not spit on the person that manages your finances. You do not spit on the bank manager. Mm-hmm. And by going to war with them, the one thing we do know is that the currency system is one of the oldest systems we've got.
It's not so old. It's not so old. It's 700 years old.
So far. It's probably older than that.
No. It with the function, it has credit and interest. It's 700 years old.
I think the coin is like 2,000 years old or 3,000 years old.
Yes, but without interest. And more as a institutionalized thing, I think. If I remember correctly.
Well, I think that's the only thing. The only reason I brought it up is I thought that, you know, and maybe an example of the elites not always agreeing with each other and then making, you know, obviously one empire fall and the other one. You know what I'm saying? I don't. Something about it seems odd that if they had that much control, well, maybe they have no control over it. That's why it's just cyclical. Maybe we're controlled more by celestial, you know, moon, sun, planets than we realize, you know?
Do you know what's funny? Everybody at the end of every cycle has the same conversation. There's so many archives of different things being said like this from years ago, saying, well, other people that are running this money-based, and it always ends up the same. Then there's a big catastrophe. Then we end up about where we are. It's pretty much the same. Think beyond that. Right? The people who run the place have chosen money as a tool. So all you've got to do is work out the tool they've chosen. They've chosen it, right? Why have they chosen money? Then you can work back. Once you work back to why the tool was chosen, then you can work out that we are being controlled. It doesn't go any further. You don't have to go into big raptures about what people use. It's a tool. That's all it is.
Different things there, but I mean, I definitely agree that money is a form of control.
Yeah, it's a tool. That's all it is. It's just a tool. We were controlling lots of other ways in the past.
I have a question. Which is that group? Which is the one the more that run the place, as you say? Do you have a group? I have mine.
Alan, I named them the aristocrats. The art people. The aristocrats. Not aristocrats. Uh-huh. Aristocrats. They're the ones that give you, you see.
Is it a human group? Is it a human group or is it devil, or as Frank says?
Well, it's from the same ground as, I don't know what, I can't define human. Okay. But it's from the same ground where we are. Yeah, definitely, because it's not hard to manipulate people.
Yes, we see that every day.
Yeah, so...
But back to Frank's question, though, about the control, right? Isn't it... I don't know, you know what I'm trying to say? Like, maybe not.
I believe that this place has been run, and has been run, by the same people that probably took over it. We could be a shipwrecked vessel. We could be anything. We don't match. We don't match what's on the land apart from one plant, and that plant is being sold is illegal. So that doesn't make sense to me. No. I know. I'll tell you. There's a few correlations actually. So, marijuana, humans, and. Discoveries, let's put it that way. But discoveries of the land. It seems that there was a clandestine. Yeah, it seems there's a clandestine effort to discover lands that are potent for marijuana. If that sounds weird, I know. Don't worry. But yeah.
Okay.
It's not a natural plant, should I say. And that, you know, the first people I've heard that I've been looking into, and I've been looking in between lines and reading a bit, a few bits, it's not clandestine. It's not.
Just to add what Frank had said earlier, because obviously he's interested in something I'm not very researched in myself, but isn't my, I kind of have like an understanding that also people who believe in the devil or quote unquote Satan are really just Saturn worshippers, the planet Saturn. Is that true, Frank? I don't know.
Frank has, he can not hear you now. He has his headphones on his head, on his ears. Sorry.
Oh, okay.
Yes, but I think it's not like that. I'm also not sure because I have not much knowledge about the Saturn and the devil. I'm not sure.
Because I think what Napoleon's saying too is like this whatever the agenda is. It sounds like you're saying too is like whatever the agenda is. It's been going on for a very long time, and whatever this group of people are, they're continuing going forward with whatever the plan is.
Yes, and I don't believe that. I don't see that. I have a completely different point of view.
Well, I'm sure if you change your point of view from another point of view, you might be able to see it.
Yes, I see. I can understand how it erupts, you know, because if we look in the history, into history in periods of deep crisis, there are always there are metaphysical tendencies and religious factions are flowering. And this could be one explanation.
It's interesting to see how easily people are motivated to do things that aren't necessarily the best things for them to do, you know?
Yes.
Especially when people are desperate, when people, you know, just want to be part of a group. You know, I think we've all even experienced it probably in our childhood, you know, what people do to get where they want. So I kind of see more that I feel like it's not controlled, but it's controlled. There's the illusion of control and we are being controlled. And maybe it's our job to figure out how to be free, you know, from the system.
May I ask you, what's your name? Or do we call you Want Truth for Nahal? That's so long.
Oh, yeah. No, you can...
You have a nickname for here in the chat?
Yeah, well, yeah, Vidya already said... You can just call me Matt. It's fine.
Matt.
No, Matt, not Matt.
Matt, truly. I'm sorry.
Not the call, the call.
Frank, you were not here. Matt, I'm sorry again. Answered your question and asked something about the devil and Saturn. If that's the same, the belief in that the place is run by the devil and the Saturn worshippers. If that's the same.
And what was the answer?
We need your answer.
No, I'm not really. Experienced enough in these ideas. I mean, it seems to me that all of the, if you like, religious texts are 60% deception with some elements of truth.
Mm-hmm.
But my key point is to try and understand whether it is humankind that is in drive, that is driving the system, or whether mm-hmm. it is not humankind. That's really
how
my.
Do you know 60% is true and 40% is not, or 60% is not true and 40% is true. How do you come up with that number?
I simply use the principle of inversion. That whatever if I'm told that something is, you know, 60% true and only 40% not true, then I assume that I'm being lied to. It's not a very scientific way of approaching it.
Wouldn't it better to be used the number 33 instead? Like it's 30%.
Okay, that's perfectly okay. Well, but it's just an idea that in each of these texts, in each of the religions, there are elements that appear to have powerful explanatory power.
I sometimes see that text of that from used in the past as a way of dumbing it down for the population who may not be as educated to understand really what they're saying. Like, you know, I think there's parts of the Bible that were really just a survival guide for back in the day when human beings needed to survive, you know, and maybe it wasn't as easy.
May I say something?
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, yeah.
Absolutely not, Mism. You are restrained.
You mentioned this picture. You said either it's a machine run by humans or not by humans. Is that right?
Well, firstly, you've entered. We've now got three alternatives. Mm-hmm. One is that it's a machine that's now, if you like, in a self-organizing mode, and we're just members of the organization and we fill our roles. The other is that the machine is in place and it's run by humans. And the other that the, you know, if you like, society, if there is such a thing, is not run by humans. And that's, I guess, the three alternatives, isn't it?
The devil? Where's the devil? If we have the devil.
That would be the not human.
Ah, the machine itself. Well,
is the machine governments or machines?
No, the machine is a metaphor for the whole, for how technology and humanity interfere, something like that.
A machine is the organization of people into their roles, etc.
Well, what is the organization other than government?
Wow, that's a big one. So I would argue that the governments as you perceive them don't exist at all.
Well, there's all different types of governments, aren't there?
Anyway, whatever the system is, whatever the thing that results in more roads being built in my local area, the thing I'm talking about.
I see another picture for the situation. Firstly, I don't believe this machine that is self-conscious, as in Odyssey 2001, which is massively propagated. I believe that is one of the big psyops that are taking place, because that is not possible with the digital technology. So,
and I simply agree with you, is all I can say.
Pardon?
I agree with you. I don't think consciousness can grow from complexity. I think that's a nonsense.
Yes, that's nonsense. I think that. So we can let the devil also outside. Is that right? Yes, but I believe that humans are the decision makers, but the complexity of those decision makers has also undergone a process of complexity. There are more players, and there are more complex matters to rule over. And, of course, there are new divisions to make. Who takes what and who reigns over what? That's all in under reconstruction in this period. Yeah, that's what I meant. So the humans are under control, but the humans are also in competitive relationships, and the society, that means the humans, are involved in many of, or in a part of that process. But they have not their own organizations. They are not strongly related with their interests, for example. Only a few parts of societies can see that have their interests. For example, if they are profitable for the decision makers, they were pushed. Let's see, transgender agenda, or I don't know, that children shall be allowed to have sexuality with 10 years, or shall marry with 12 years. That's profitable also for the whole machine. So it is
progress.
Helped, let's say.
Yes,
yes, it is from the decision maker. It is supported. But my picture is my picture is yes. Right. I'm sorry.
You believe that it's all humans that are in control? Not
yes, of course.
Okay.
I don't have any doubt about that. I mean, God is an idea. It is very important idea for humans, but it is also clear that God is an idea that does not intervene in human interactions. That's the meaning of the old religions. And if one has one, it's good. If one has not a religion, it's another category of thinking. But in my picture, it is like a big LKW or like a big car. And those who are driving and adults, the decision makers, are drunk and take cocaine all the time and have loud music and run. And the society, they are in the back seats like children, and they are playing with some stuff and do not realize the...
So what's an example of yes. disunity amongst the ruling elite? I mean, I can only think of examples of unity among the ruling elite.
Oh, there are many examples about them not being one unity. They are absolutely competitive. They are even in the fakery or on the fakery level. There are many signs, from my point of view, that tell us that are not always the same structures that do these fakeries.
Okay, so but what's your
that's one example?
What's an example of disunity that you can point to?
Syria.
Yeah. So what's the problem with Syria? As far as I can see, that's yeah. entirely a construct to disrupt the tribes in the you know that are not part of the they're not part of the you know the world system.
Yes, for me that's you know that's the one point I would want to point to. It is not the aim to disrupt the tribes. It is the aim to profit from some pipelines, and the one wants the pipelines here, the other one wants the pipelines there. It is a positive, in a quote-unquote positive. It means it has a positive result. They make profit of it, and the tribes must be destroyed. It is not that they are just thinking, oh, we must destroy the tribes. All the destruction is a result of some other disease.
Yeah, but there's no evidence. So there's no evidence of disunity amongst the destroyers. They're obviously
all. Oh, of
all
course. They would like. Some
parts. I don't know if it's disunity, but there's definitely evidence that humans are controlling this situation. I mean, look at the pyramids, and they built those, and then we come through the Dark Ages, and then we come back up through, like, you know, what it is today. Like, there's obviously some sort of cycle of rise and falls, there's depressions, there's rise and falls of empires, right? I mean, we see. There's clearly an example of humans throughout history, at least from what they tell us.
Yeah, I don't think anyone would say there's evidence of a rise and fall of empire.
I'm sorry, you would say there was
just to interject briefly, does anyone here think that Iran will be attacked? And if so, when?
Iran. I think rather than Iran will attack Iran.
I think the big focus is going to be Europe in the next coming year.
We have many, many areas of potential war.
The view is after Iraq, then Iran type thing. You know, the list of peanut countries to be taken.
Well, that would be the American British Empire that would prefer to attack Iran. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yes, but it's not the only empire at the moment, and it's in decline.
There's only one empire.
No,
what empire is in decline, by the way?
The Anglo-American empire is in decline.
Based on what evidence?
Based on the debt, based on the rise of the Chinese, Asian, I don't know. I'm not very good in geopolitics, guys.
I don't see that.
They print the money they're in their debt.
But you know, to say that the Anglo Empire is in decline is really to assume that they had no part in shifting all production from around the world into China. I don't think that idea holds any validity at all.
Right.
Why would the American guys deliberately transfer their own production power to China and concentrate all production in China?
Have all our power.
I mean, I think there's probably a ton of reasons as to why they transferred manufacturing and stuff like that to places for selfish, short-term goals.
Well, So they deliberately destroyed their own power base. It's ridiculous.
Or did they destroy their own power?
There is only one world power. Now, the idea that there are separate governments, that's just nonsense.
A pantomime.
I don't know. Maybe I have a false picture of the United States at the moment, but what I read is that there is no middle class left. There are no jobs.
Yes, but that's
there is only military and 3,000 approximately military bases around the world which cannot afford their existence because they run on debt. And,
but again, that idea, all the infrastructure is destroyed. But the whole debt thing is just a decision the American government made, isn't it? They're in debt to their own bank.
No. They're not in debt to their own bank. They're in debt to the world economy.
No, that's completely untrue.
No.
Listen, 70 or 80% of U.S. debt is owed to the U.S. Federal Reserve.
Oh, no, that's wrong.
Oh, absolutely, I'm correct on that. I can find that out for you easily.
You have to find it, maybe, yes, because one big part is owned by Chinese.
No, it's about banks. 5% at the most. And China is more in debt than anyone.
Exactly. China has been on a decline since 2007.
Since 2008, yes, something like that. The American economy. Are you putting economy, Matt?
Every single country in the world, every single world government is in debt to something.
Exactly. That's how government functions.
Have you ever heard of a government that has paid off its debt?
No, that's exactly the case. No government in the history of the world has ever paid back its debts.
Except Greece.
Literally no government has ever paid back its debts. So they'll just get rid of the currency and start over again. That's what they always do. There's evidence of that.
Yes, but isn't there at the moment, Matt and Frank, maybe you know about this, because I don't know much about economy, but there is a movement from the Asian countries, I don't know, Iran, China, India, Hong Kong, Malaysia, Philippines, to bind the world transactions to gold, back to gold, to the gold standard, out of the fiat money.
I don't think that's it.
What? It's gold is just another tokenism. There's no, you know, whatever.
Yes, it's a token, but
yellow metal.
You know, it's not that. You know, if any change in currency occurs, it's because the world government has directed whatever the currency changes are going to be as they move from Phoenicia to Venice to England, to Amsterdam, yes, and Amsterdam to London, and etc.
Yes, Frank, but you know, when, for example, 10 years earlier, when the United States would say it will work like that, the other country had to do it. There was no chance. And when some countries tried, for example, to do their transactions with oil, with the euro, they were taken out.
Who told you that, though?
Pardon?
Who told you that?
Saddam Hussein was taken out. Gaddafi was taken out.
They're all just actors, aren't they?
Yeah, they're all
people playing a role.
They were actors, but they were replaced because one of the reasons was because of the transactions with euro instead with dollar.
I think that's ludicrous.
Debt? What is debt?
Guilt-free
that's history. That's history.
So, but what is
build
the debt?
In order to destroy.
Can someone tell me what the debt thing. Is?
The debt.
Yeah, no, what is the debt? The debt that we, that I guess the United States government, which has not as much debt as other countries, you know.
Germany is.
Yeah, it's got less than Australia per person, I think.
Truthfully, at the end of the day, I mean, what is the debt? They're bonds, aren't they not? Isn't it not just the banks? That's the reason the banks have control over the governments, because they buy and sell the debt, a.k.a. they buy and sell bonds.
Et cetera, et cetera. That's right. Because so when the U.S. government needs money, it gets printed by the U.S. Federal Reserve, and the amount of money that is printed is owed to the U.S. Federal Reserve. And the U.S. Federal Reserve is a private bank, independent of the U.S. government. Now, why would the U.S. government, why wouldn't the U.S. government just create its own money for its own purposes? The same as every other government in the world. Why don't they do that?
I was reading that is not quite true about the Federal Reserve. That's also some kind of myth. But I'm not sure. I'm not sure, really.
The Federal Reserve exists?
No, I'm saying that it is the official bank of the United States government. It is not. It is a public institution. It's not a private bank. That's what I'm reading. I was reading that. I'm not sure if it's like
on record as saying on video that the Federal Reserve is not owned by the U.S. government and doesn't take its instructions from the U.S. government.
As I said, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
The myth of the duck hunts on Jekyll Island is a big sort of Hollywoodish myth. Sneaky Jews took over in the middle of the night when no one was looking.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's just another ridiculous story. Everything has been planned out right from the start, as if, you know, they make it sound out that there's some democratic process that occurred in the USA that could have stopped it, or JFK was going to do something with silver and so they assassinated. It's all just nonsense.
Like things happen spontaneously, it's all bollocks.
I didn't understand. Do you mean really that there is a big plan going on since centuries?
But tell me, what is your explanation?
I asked for your explanation.
My explanation is, I think the idea, as I've said right from the start, the idea that the devil is the prince of the world,
okay.
I think that model is consistent with what we observe today. So the alternative is, when we talk about that model being incorrect, as you said, and you openly say that model is obviously incorrect, right, in your view. And so what is the zeitgeist that drives the current situation? And what your view is that there are different world governments competing and so on.
Let me ask you something else.
I'm simply demonstrating to you that the idea different governments is clearly untrue. And I can give a whole bunch of quite obvious examples. So, for example, every government of the world sold their gold in whatever year it was, 1972 or 1982 or something.
Sold the gold.
To who? Yeah, we don't know. But they all, every government around the world, the Australian government, the US government, Gordon Brown, the German government, they all sold massive amounts of gold.
To who?
When was Gordon Brown the Prime Minister?
I don't remember.
Anyway, it was then, and gold was sold for
2012.
No, much earlier than that.
Prime Minister just off the Blair one. Didn't he take over as an elected Prime Minister?
Yeah. Anyway, it was Gordon Brown that sold it all.
Frank, and are you saying that the devil runs also the banks? If I understand it, do I understand that right? I'm not sure what you say.
I'm saying the model that the devil runs the entire planet is the prince of the world.
Here's some more examples of uniformity.
Every English speaking world sold off their power stations, their utilities. They sold off their.
Don't mean to be rude, but can I have an answer? What devil?
Whatever the devil is.
Oh. The devil out of the book.
Out of the Bible, yeah.
Abraham's devil. So the God of Abraham's devil.
Okay, or the book does he want, Frank?
It would follow that you'd have to accept the God of Abraham to accept the devil.
Say that again.
But that you would have to accept everything in the Bible and the God of Abraham to accept the concept of Satan.
Well, you don't have to accept anything. I'm simply saying, right, that at the moment the idea is that are we saying that governments are all separate, vying for each other and competing for each other? And I'm just going to give you a whole bunch of examples where I think all of the governments are behaving as one entity. And the examples I'm going to give you are, first of all, selling off of gold,
I can't confirm that. You say this, but there's things you say I can't confirm. Now, how can you say they sell gold? And again, when you bring up the devil too, it just seems very, not controlled, but it just seems like someone planted that idea in your head that there's this entity called the devil.
Never mind the devil. It's glaring that all these entities are in collusion with one another.
They're not unique ideas. These are things that we're told.
I have a question. We can discuss it. From my point of view, it's okay if we discuss about the devil. I could take it as a metaphor. I don't have a problem.
I'm asking to take the devil offline now. Before we do, take the devil offline. I am asking, I've made a model to you. I've suggested to you that I think the things are consistent. But what I'm asking for from you guys, if you've got one, is your view about how the spirit of the world, where does it come from? How is it driven?
Yes, I can tell you what I see. I mean that we live in the transition from the nation states to the corporate state. And there are, as I said, there are quite a lot of antagonism in the elites. I believe that there are parts in the elites. It is not a homogeneous group or something. They are not the Bilderbergers. They are not just the banks. That it's a more complex situation. Of course, a very strong part of the who drives the historical process, let's say, or the situation where we are in, are those who own the big technology structures, Boeing, Halifax, Facebook, eBay, Amazon, I don't know the names of all the machines for the airplanes, I don't know, many, many things, all these parameters. It's a very complex situation. A very big part is the...
I'm not finished, Frank.
Very important will it be who is going to get the ability first to drive the big data, to use them for decisions, for their agendas. And yes, that's my answer to the question you put.
And do you think those people have your interests at heart?
Pardon? I didn't understand all the questions.
Those people that are...
Why are you letting them have that much control over your well-being? That's what I don't understand. Like, these hypothetical people that... You know, it's like there's a lot of things I hear here too. It's like it's interesting because like to hear that China is going to be the new world thing, and it's like and then even when you said earlier, like why would the U.S. let all those manufacturing jobs go to China? It's because obviously they've come to the point where they can do automation, and then they're going to have a billion people in China with no work, and what's going to happen there? You know what I'm saying? Like technology changes, things change, and I don't everything's selfish in my opinion, and I don't really see. I don't know. I don't think it's as organized as we think it is.
But then it's, I can see it in both ways. I can see it not being organized, and I can see it, if you look at, like, you know, the company Alphabet, for example, that owns Google and owns Apple and owns, you know, Disney and owns all these other companies. And it's like...
Alphabet? I never heard of that.
Yeah, no. They're the ones that...
They own everything from that? Oh.
Yeah, so, but I mean, you just raised it up. I mean, this stuff is searchable. It's like, well, who are these people?
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
And I, back to how this whole thing, when I first came on here, too, I know some people, and I'm telling you, the more money some people have, the more they don't care about anyone else other than themselves. Like, it's selfishness. I don't know. And I think that's what drives the world.
That's what drives the world.
My opinion is it's the same few thousand families, hereditary psychopaths, who control everything.
That's probably true.
And that's it.
I'm just going to throw my two cents in, if that's all right. I probably at least largely agree with Frank in the sense that, you know, these guys, when you get behind the scenes, you find out that they're working together, and that governments are largely an illusion, and really it's corporate-based control. You know, and often when you look into the big corporates like the Alphabet companies, Google and, excuse me, Facebook and all that kind of thing, you find out that they rose to power through massive government grants. You know, they're funded into their position. So the government sort of largely works to sort of hand out the money to the people that are on the inside. You know, and those same psychopathic families with a history of owning the money down through the centuries, you know, still in control. And just quickly, Meeson mentioned before that Greece was the only country that paid back its corporate debt. Its debt. And I don't know that I'm capable of putting this into words properly, but what happened in Greece is, as I heard it illustrated, was the government built up debt to the corporates, and when Greece was forced to pay that money back, they actually created a legal precedent whereby effectively what they instituted into law was that if a government creates debt to corporates, the corporates are able to claim their debt back from the populace, from you know, the assets that belong to the actual people. Having done that, there's now a legal precedent whereby corporates can raid nations for their actual real assets.
Sounds to reason.
Yeah. And that's all part of... Yeah, so like in New Zealand, we've been, you know, negotiating the TPP and all that sort of thing. And, of course, all part of the whole Agenda 21, Agenda 2030, which is all where, you know, the corporates have huge...
I'm sorry. When did Greece pay back the debts? I've never heard this. They're at 179 times debt.
160 years, I think.
Yeah. Okay. So when I say that, but I'm no financial expert. What I don't mean is that they have paid back their debt. What I do mean is that private debt housed in corporations is able to be claimed against national assets. So in other words, people in the Greek government built up debt, and one of them was for, I heard somebody talking about it, and it was something ridiculous. It was like $200 million for a nuclear submarine built by whatever, some company. that never even got built, but they still owed the $200 million, right? And so, but the point is, the legal precedent is the debt is incurred by the government, right? The government defaults on the debt. The corporation has the right to claim against the national assets. And that's was kind of the
way I guess, and I guess my point is that for places like Australia and even the USA, the idea that the government can default on a debt is just a total fabrication, because the Australian government still has the power, as far as I know, to create as much Australian currency as it wishes. So the Australian government can never really run out of money to pay its own debts. And that should also be true of the US. But it's not.
Yeah, well, I mean, I totally agree that it's smoke and mirrors, but what I'm trying to get across is that the Greek, in my opinion, Greece was a Masonic operation, right, whereby the money's fake, right? Money's completely artificial. It's not even printed. It's pixels on a screen, right? But you allocate the pixels from the left-hand screen to the right-hand screen, and then you say, oh, sorry, a yellow submarine didn't come through, but you still owe the $200 million. But what it's really about, the only thing that actually holds value is the real assets. The money's worthless, but the land, you know, the cows, the trees, they're real value. And what it established was, that people who are out of control of the populace, we call them government, right? We have no control over them. Those people can go and rack up debts against our will, and when they default on the debts for things that we didn't want and didn't ask for, the corporates have legal right to come and take our stuff off us.
And that's equally true in China, by the way.
Interestingly, it was gold manufactured the papers so that Greece can become part of the European Union, and even more interesting was that it was Goldman Sachs who drove the crisis in 2008 against the euro. Greece was only the weakest part of the euro. It was an attack to break down the currency.
But wasn't the euro model after the United States?
No, not the same. Yes, it was Goldman Sachs.
It was modeled after.
Actually, did it in the spring of 2007 with the subprime mortgages.
Exactly. Yeah, and they shifted it over to Greece.
Well, my understanding, the issue with Europe is they never centralized the debts. Every country still owns their debts, so they haven't centralized it. And then that will be the downfall of the euro, because it's not centralized. I mean, that's what they say, at least. But
the European Union seems to be a must-be, like the United Nations. So it is going to happen. It's an eventuality.
What's going to happen?
The EU bank is just the same as the US Fed. All governments owe money to a bank, money that they could perfectly easily create themselves.
Yeah, every central bank around the world is like that.
And there's simply no reason. Well, up until quite recently in Australia, the Australian government was responsible for their own creation of currency. When they created more currency than they took back in taxes, that was called a deficit. And when they took back in taxes more than they spent, that was called a surplus. And, you know, the amount of money was allocated on that basis. And then money has also grown in Australia when a bank gives a loan to someone to buy a house, they say, oh, look, Frank, you borrow $500,000 to buy a house. You sign here. And as far as we're concerned, we haven't created any money because you've got $500,000. We've got this agreement from you to stand good for the $500,000, so net effect is zero. But that, of course, creates massive inflation in Australia for housing just by that system of that $500,000 flooding into the economy. And the net debt of Australia to overseas banks is equivalent to the amount of money owed on private housing, almost to the dollar. And there's just no reason for the Australian government to borrow U.S. money.
So, for example, this is my understanding of inflation and my understanding of
kind of how it works and how you can see if the governments are retracting or expanding. But, for example, the numbers that they're putting out, according to all the central banks of the world, they have, like, that data. It shows that the GDP, for an example, of Australia is at 0.8, but the inflation rate is 1.8. So you would minus that, and you could see that the actual economy of Australia is technically shrinking by 1%.
It's different to that, too, because the idea is that they're only talking about the price of a piece of steak or something, but asset prices, especially here and in New Zealand, are skyrocketing. House prices in my suburb in the last 12 months have gone up by 35%.
You're listening to another hour of Fakeologist Audio Chat on Fakeologist.com.
Check that. Yeah, so it went up 34, whatever, what's the big deal, man? I live in Southern California, everything's crazy expensive, it's shot up, and like, it's insane how much the real estate's gone up in the short period of time.
So that's in complete contradiction to the idea that there's a low inflation environment, isn't it?
The reason that prices have gone up so quick here is because capital is trying to flee countries like India and China, and that's being funneled into the United States. As I will tell you, that's what's changing here.
So what is inflation?
Inflation is an excess of the amount of money available competing for the assets and stuff that's there.
That's correct. So I think it was Lenin or Marx, could be wrong. I think it was one of those guys that said, inflation is the method by which governments steal money from the populace, and not one man in a million will know it.
Yep.
Sounds right.
Yep. So, you know, I mean, that's actually what we're witnessing. We're not witnessing market forces, you know, inflate. We're witnessing theft.
And there's not a single... And just going back to my earlier comments with you, Mism, this is happening in concert to Le Monde. There is no evidence at all that governments compete with each other.
I'm sorry, there's no evidence that governments what?
Compete with each other or are different entities. Every government in the world is doing exactly the same thing, is under the same centralized banking system.
I would not say that that's true at all. I would definitely say governments around the world are definitely competing for business and for things like that. I think that that's a given.
Yeah,
that's what a consulate is for. A consulate in any area where you are, they are there specifically to attract business. Of course, there's things for their citizens or whatever, but really it's a vector for them to create business in that region.
All governments are corporations, and they'll be competing to a certain level, but at the top, they'll all have the same directives.
Yeah, that's the key. It's the corporates that run the world. And there's a guy by the name, he's got a really random name that I can never pronounce. Think of it later, but he actually did a tour in New Zealand, and I've looked at his website and stuff. My old boss linked to him. Anyway, he goes around. One of the things that he mainly shows, and this is a difficulty, but on the subject of fakery, is that if you want to look at the GDP and then minus the inflation and blah, 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 all of those figures are fake. They're fake, and he proves it. And he just, at the conference that my old boss went to, he took one nation as an example, and he went through their figures, and he showed how they just totally don't add up. They just don't add up. You take the sectors, and you add them up, and you compare it to the GDP that's, you know, we're told, and the inflation figures, et cetera, et cetera. And the point is... you know, I'm no financial expert, but the fact is all the figures are fudged. And so what's let out into the marketplace and the stuff that, you know, you can stand there discussing and saying, well, inflation is X and they're doing this.
I think what we're saying, or at least what I guess I'm saying, is that I don't believe, I'm just with the same mentality of view, is that it is most likely faked as well. But at the end of the day, that's the numbers that they are giving us, and that's the numbers that we can look at. And if you have an understanding of how that system works,
translate what that really means. And most people don't really know, doesn't really understand what is national debt. Where does this come from? What is it? How is it sold? How is it bought? What does it mean? I mean, what does this mean? You know, people hear it all day and they don't really know what it means.
I think what they do is employ obfuscation to hide the real cause of the debt. Go ahead.
Yeah.
I mean, to be honest, I mean, obviously all these debts are going crazy, but I don't know if it's another thing, but I would assume that it's basically trying to tell us that they're trying to break down each one of these governments, right? I mean, isn't that kind of a goal?
Yeah. I think quickly going back to the Greek thing, I think the money is a tool, right? And the debt is, the purpose of the debt has been established is to take from the civilians what they own.
Yep. It's to take their assets.
Well, aren't they trying to take as much taxes as they can from each one of us so that way they can just pay back the interest of this quote-unquote debt that the government owes?
Yeah, but that's a classic example. So like, I'm overtaxed, right, because my government has gone out and bought stuff that I had no say in and probably didn't want, right? So then I got to give them my tax money, which puts financial pressure on me. So I go out and get a credit card, et cetera, et cetera. And I can't afford a house, so I go and get a $500,000 mortgage and so on and so on. So I end up with this massive debt pile. And then sooner or later, you know, if it all goes bang, based on the Greece example, then the corporations that get defaulted on have the right to enter my country and say, right, we'll have that forest and we'll have that, you know, the Canterbury Plains and the dairy farms and so on and so on. And that's the principle that's been established. And so you can end up, like, for example, and I know this has happened in multiple places, but I probably can't cite one for you, where farmers walk off their land without leaving. You know, they default on their loan, they end up managing the farm, but they don't own the land and they don't earn the profits and so on and so on.
Just as an aside.
It's interesting, can I just say, it's interesting you bring that up, because that's exactly what I was speaking yesterday with a few people that are on this. There's that guy, Martin Armstrong, and that's exactly what he says, is exactly what you said, is that it's switching from private, from public to private. Now, corporations are purchasing.
That's everything I'm saying. The debt is a tool for the corporates to lever the assets out of private ownership.
No, it's for the corporation to take it out of public ownership.
Yeah, so out of private. Yeah, out of the.
Yeah.
Well, but actually.
Practically, then, in, let's say, 10 years. Oh, I hear my voice. I try it again. I go out. Sorry.
One of the things that I am always puzzled with is how it is that a U.S. citizen can't understand that if they're spending U.S. dollars created by the U.S. government, why is it that they're in debt? Can anyone explain to me why U.S. people have realized that there's some kind of strange fraud going on?
I can explain it. Yes. The Fed prints money. And that money is in the market. They buy oil with that, and they buy, I don't know, diamonds and all the things that the U.S. economy buys in other countries are paid with these dollars, which are printed. But they cycle. They go from one to the other, from one to the other. And no one asks their money back. They are.
But that's a different question, Ms. If the U.S. government, if the money being spent is U.S. money, which the U.S. government can create if it chooses to out of nowhere, how can, you know, if I'm able to pay for all my debts by simply writing a check from my checkbook, right?
Mm-hmm. That's what it means.
If people accept that as full payment, yeah?
Yes.
Then that's it. I don't know.
Yes, but in the problem,
I think the debt, and it's understood here, is because of social programs, for an example.
No, you're missing the point. When the money...
Well, that you can't just take free things away. You can't get free things away and not think that doesn't cost money.
When the U.S. government used to print money until 1913, this is the point. Until 1913, when the U.S. government created a U.S. dollar, that was it. All that happened was it expanded the money supply. It didn't go into debt. When the Federal Reserve was created, the Federal Reserve is a private bank, and then the U.S. government, every time it needed some money, it went to the U.S. Federal Reserve, give me some money, and then we owe you that amount. Now, it's as simple as that. I don't understand why it's so difficult to realize what is going on with that U.S. Federal Reserve. It's not complicated.
Well,
the U.S. government, at the stroke of a pen, could introduce a state that simply says, oh, yeah, we're now going to print our own money.
I don't think the government's not in control.
Duh.
Why are you thinking of the government's in control?
Exactly. The government's not in control, and that's what I'm asking is, U.S. people to realize what's going on with their money? Why don't they ask, to whom are we in debt?
I think it goes back to what Napoleon said. It was a quote about bankers or whatever. Like, you don't do something to the banker or something like that. And I think at the end of the day, it's like the banker is the one that buys and sells each one of these government debts around the world. And so, therefore, they're the ones who are in control of the governments.
But why? I mean, the U.S. government is entitled to produce all the money it wishes.
I'm sorry, the U.S. government's entitled to what?
The U.S. government is entitled to produce as much money as it wishes.
Maybe the U.S. government and the debt is what the banks really are accruing, and when it's just too high or whatever, they just decide to flip a switch. They decide just to let that government fall and crash and whatever and switch to the next one somewhere else, you know? You can follow where capital's moving all the time and figure out what's really going on and stuff like that.
But do you understand what I mean by how can the U.S. government be in debt? Everybody uses U.S. money. Everybody. U.S. money.
South America, and they were using it there. They used it more than they used it.
U.S. money is used by everybody. And that means that if the U.S. government is producing the U.S. money, it can never be in debt, can it?
It will be automatically in debt when all the transactions that are done today with the dollar as a leading currency are suddenly no more done with the dollar, but for example with the euro or with the yuan.
Who will
the U.S. be in debt to?
If you created the currency, if you created the system, how are you in debt when you created this? Is that what you're saying, kind of thing? Like, how can you make
the basic principle? The U.S. government, the U.S. dollar is the currency, but in fact, the answer is it's not the U.S. government dollar. It is the Federal Reserve dollar. It's the Fed dollar. That's the whole premise. The point I keep trying to make over and over is, currency production in the U.S. is done by a private bank called the U.S. Federal Reserve. And what I can continue to be amazed at is why most Americans are completely unaware that they are made in debt to a private bank, producing currency that they could produce themselves. And by the way, the same is now in Australia. The Australian government, which can produce its own currency, does so, is now borrowing $132 million a day and has since, for the last 10 years or something, when it never used to do that before. Absolutely no reason is our government doing that. Our government can produce as much money as it wishes because the only currency that you can spend in Australia is the Commonwealth of Australia stamped on it. And the same in New Zealand.
You keep on breaking up.
Pity.
I'm Frank.
Is that Frank that's talking? Yeah, that's Frank, right?
Yeah, it was me that was talking, yeah.
Okay, yeah, you're breaking up.
So did you hear me say that the Australian government can produce as much money as it wishes?
Yeah, I heard that, but yeah.
And you heard me say
that's at the end of the day,
the only currency
by assets, right?
Say that again?
Then in some way it's backed by assets then, right? Or no assets.
Well, in fact, currency, when people are in a country, and they give power to the government to create money, what they're saying is, we are agreeing on a system, on a medium of exchange between parties involved in the, if you like, the Australian economy. Okay?
So I get here, you keep on breaking up, Frank.
I'm not quite sure why. Am I too far or too closer?
I don't know, but you know, I just, everything you were saying, it made me think. I'm like, well, is the United States not an example of a one world government?
It is exactly an example.
It is. It's got military everywhere. It has a diverse population. Everyone's from somewhere else. You know, it's, you know, it seems like they're trying to make Europe, turn Europe into the same kind of thing.
I think the U.S. undertakes at least 70% of military spending.
When you said where's the debt, that's where I'm like, it's in the military.
Frank, if you... The answer to your question, really, if you buy into their explanation of their system, is that, you know, the debt that America creates, at least amongst it, you know, they use a lot of treasury bonds and stuff like that, which have a fixed term and I believe a fixed return or whatever. So you might have a 5-year bond with a, I don't know the figures, a 15% return. And so whoever wants to buys them, so then they have a technical debt, so they're going to owe another 15% 5 years from now. And everyone's aware of the fact that the US government can print as much money as they want to pay that debt back, right? And everyone, well, and the official narrative is that if they were to print that money today to pay all of their debts, which kind of they are doing anyway, because what are they doing? $84 billion a month or something, or a day? Is it a day? I can't remember. But the answer is that everyone kind of agrees to agree that if they hit the button that says, we'll print all the money that they can pay all their debts back today, everyone agrees that then the money becomes worthless and nobody wants it, right? So that's kind of supposedly the answer. That people know that they can print it out of thin air, but nobody wants them to at that level because then nobody wants the money.
Sure. I mean, it still doesn't alter the reality, does it? That, you know, what the purpose of all this money and debt and so on is for, is for exactly what you said, Justin, dude.
It's debt slavery. Yeah.
It's clearly just to be, make life difficult for the hoi polloi.
Yeah, it's a toll. And it's a toll that it doesn't just buy assets because, the greatest asset really that a nation has, and if you believe all that, I mean, you know, if you understand, I've never quite looked into the whole incorporation of an individual at birth and you sell the lifetime value and all that kind of stuff, but the point is that one of the greatest assets a nation has is the lifetime production of the individuals that are inside that nation, right? So debt slavery is the tool that doesn't just get you the assets of the nation. It purchases you the lifetimes of the human beings' production that are inside that nation. You own it. You own those people, like me. I'm a slave.
The only problem with that idea...
registered on Dun and Bradstreet on Company's House, and each nation has got the sweat equity for everyone that's under their reign type of thing.
Yeah.
Cooperation with personhood.
So the reason I got to this point about talking was really to try and ask just Want Truth or Now and Mism to try and tell me their model for the ghost, what I call the ghost in the machine. Because I think we can clearly establish that there is only one government, just from the discussion we've just had about money. So who or what is driving that one world government?
I do not agree that we have a world government.
Well, let me tell you, if the United States tells Switzerland to do something, you know they're going to do it, right? I mean, it's going to happen.
They're not going to do it, but they're going to pay the fees as they did with the UPS.
What do you mean? I think they'll do it. I think whoever is, I think just what Frank said, it's like, if that's the currency that the world is using, then that, whatever is currency that is, I think you'd have more pull and power over somebody else, right?
Yes, but it is a difference. You cannot call that government. There are strong forces, strong interests. Banks are for sure the biggest part in that, because they have the power over the currencies. And there are not many banks. I don't know which they are, and I don't understand the matter also very well about banks. But it's not the only one. That's what I'm trying. What I tried to establish.
Not only, I'm sorry. You're saying there's more than one bank. Is that?
No, that's more. It's more than the banks. It's also the electronic industry, the Boeing, the machines for the airplanes. The metal industry, I don't know, there are several productive corporations. The pharma industry is also very strong.
I think there's plenty of conglomerates in the world. I mean, I mean, I know we're all focusing on the United States here, but I mean, if you go even to India, and was it Alibaba, that's like their Amazon and other stuff. I mean, there's monopolies there as well, and I mean, they're kind of everywhere to show an example where there are companies or corporations that own all different industries on all different sides legally in some capacity, I guess, you know, or all legally, or however they do it, according to whatever government they control. But you know what I'm saying? At the end of the day, it's like there are, I don't know.
Yes, but I don't see this one world government. You should tell me who is the head of the staff and who are the ministers. I don't see it.
Well, 9 times out of 10, I feel like everyone talks about the United States, so it seems to me that it kind of speaks for itself, doesn't it?
No, for me not.
Well, how many times do we talk about the United States in this conversation? Why are we so focused on the United States if it's not?
U.S. is still under the crown via the Virginia Land Company.
Maybe so. Maybe so. Just like Canada, just like Australia.
Yeah and China.
Yeah.
India.
And, yeah, Hong Kong, Singapore, yeah, India.
The crown wants Africa, and it'll be complete.
Yeah, well, it's in South Africa already, so they already got... I mean, yeah, I can see that aspect as well.
And incursions into North Africa.
I mean, doesn't Australia have the Queen on their currency like Canada does?
Yeah, we still have the Queen.
Crown colony.
And we have, so we've got the same Queen as the Queen of England and the Queen of New Zealand, the Queen of Canada. But apparently, if you're a citizen of both the United Kingdom and Australia, you can't serve in Parliament because you've got dual citizenship. It just makes me laugh.
Interesting. It just seems more or less, I don't know, because it's like I sway between thinking that the government's controlled by corporations, because it seems to more, you know, because think about it. For example, we don't have universal health care in the United States, and health care is extremely expensive here, and so by
Broad Street, our company's house. You'll find that the governments are registered as corporations.
Yeah, well, let me just add to what I'm saying about that.
That's true.
So if we are assets, like we the people are slaves, right, and we're the assets that create this money, then why wouldn't they want to keep those people healthy and going along if corporations who are greedy are not in control? You know what I'm saying?
And healthy people produce very little turnover for the machine. Healthy people produce very little turnover for the machine. Unhealthy people are tremendously valuable to corporates. I think this is a US figure, but every cancer diagnosis is worth what was $300,000 or $300 million or whatever it was. So, you know, illness is incredibly valuable. And especially long-term illness, which can never be cured, i.e. you're on expensive drugs for the rest of your life just to keep you going.
Right, but I mean, in like all those, every other country in the like world, other than the United States, seems to have some sort of universal health care. So, you know what I'm saying? Why do they all have it except for here?
Well, except that they're
not all of them.
They're all slowly moving to the US, like Australia is.
I don't think most of the people have health insurance. There are very few countries that.
I thought all of Europe does.
No, no. Germany, Switzerland, I think England doesn't have it. France also doesn't have it. Spain not. Russia, I don't know. But I don't think so.
The UK does have it to a certain extent. That's why it's the mecca for people from Eastern Europe and that.
Mexico has it. Canada has it.
Really?
Uruguay has it. China has it.
They're socialists. They have it.
No, but like China even has it as well. So
China has a obligatory health insurance for all.
I
can't believe that.
China, and that's what they told me. So
really?
I obviously haven't lived there or checked on it, but that's what I was told.
If China has it, it's the whole world.
let me take a cheap shot here, one trick now. Don't you think the U.S. medical system is consistent with the idea that the devil runs?
You're breaking up, Frank.
I was asking one truth for now. Don't you think the U.S. health system is consistent with the idea that the devil runs the world?
No, I think it goes back to that greed and selfishness rules the world, that it's all for personal gain. I think it's all individuals.
Just going back to socialized healthcare for a moment, the positive side, I'd have been dead at least a few times if it wasn't for the Vizier, you know.
Well, thank God you're not in the United States, because you'd be dead then. Well, that was a dark conversation.
Okay, let's get back one step before the devil.
I know, right? Dude, got to bring it all down to the negative.
Okay, but I have a question too, because New World Order is always combined with the idea for a one-world government. And the only picture I have for a one-world government... Pardon?
It says New World Order on the U.S. dollar, does it not?
Yes, yes. Yes, but there were also some pop groups that were called New World Order. We don't know what it means. But it's the whole ideology. It's always combined with very much fear and devils, masons, Jews who are very dark, coming from the Caucasus, and even Muslims that are Wahhabis, and I don't know, so much fear, so much symbols of dark forces, and I don't know. And I think we should quite simple and rational analyze the things and not fall into this fear campaign.
I find that exactly what you just said, I think you're really on something there, because I think at the end of the day, the fear is what keeps us all so in control and in check, the fear of all this control and
controlliness
or whatever. It's almost like self-imposing or whatever it is that they want on us, you know? And, you know, it's interesting to me, because when I start focusing on the positive things in my life and, you know, even when things happen that I'm just not very happy about, and when I start reminding myself to not let that have control over how I'm thinking and stuff like that, how much happier I am as a person, you know? And I don't know, I just feel like that fear is just a tool that they use to keep people controlled, like the fear of debt and all that other stuff, you know? Because people, you can make debt work for you to make it into the point where you're making a profit. Like most businesses start in debt before they come to profit.
I don't know if one can change debt into profit. I'm not very good at financial matters, and I was never interested in that also. But I think it gives us more possibilities to become engaged in our lives if we do not confront metaphysical entities that rule everything. Because, you know, if I believe that the devil or aliens or alligators or I don't know run the world, I mean, I must do nothing. I have no way to protect myself and my family. So if I do not have really proof of that, I just stay with a normal human ability to analyze running.
You can manifest anything you want.
The point, Mizim, is there either are, you call them spiritual entities, but I don't think they're metaphysical entities. If it is non-humans that are running the planet, they're not metaphysical. They're real creatures. And secondly, the idea is if the model of the Bible is correct, then you do have simple protection from these entities, and that's just through prayer. Now, the alternative is, as you say, that that's not the case and it's just people. And so your difficulty then is to participate in a way that gets the system to start working on behalf of humankind rather than what I think we could clearly establish is not to our benefit at the moment. I don't think the current system is beneficial to humanity in any way, shape, or form.
I agree with you on that.
And, so maybe this is the foundation that they need to create what's best for everybody in the future. You know what I'm saying? Maybe that's the whole point of, like, the Freemasonry and its building of something. You know, like, where, well, you know, humanity tried this and it didn't work.
The idea of Freemasonry is that man needs to be perfected.
I don't think people must be perfected. I think the laws must be perfected and the banks must be socialized immediately and the public education must be completely undergo a revival and, the restructuring and some other things that would be very simple if... Yes, if the people would want it, they could do it.
So, to go back a little bit earlier in the piece with the discussion about do we or don't we currently have a new world order, or, you know, a one world government, more accurately, I think kind of both Frank and Mason are right to a degree, and what I mean by that is I think at the moment, so we do really have a one-world government that rules from behind the scenes, and when I say government, I think the power that rules our world is corporate, you know, not people who are voted into office. But I also think that we're in a transition phase where the people who do own the money and do rule, the elites, they're not happy with the current illusion of democracy and voting, et cetera, et cetera. And I think there's places where they've quite openly stated that they want want to go to a technocratic system. You know, and we see that in place in part in the EU and various things. But I think they want to do away with this old system and move in totality to a system where we can recognize openly that we do have a one world government and that we are ruled by technocrats, non-elected officials. Does that make sense?
I think some of the things that you say are true. I think at the end of the day, a lot of this stuff is at the local level. You can make changes at the local level. I'm a strong believer in that, and I've witnessed it firsthand, and I think, you know, you just, and if you believe that you're not, then I think you're just telling the world that, I don't know, it's a lot of things is how we manifest things in our day-to-day lives. It's how we think, and I think if we think that
I'm never going to be rich, or I'm never going to have this, or you know, like the government's in control, and like I'm out of, like they have all the control over me, then you're giving that power to the to the world. You're telling the world they have all this power, they have all this stuff. I'm never going to do that. You're telling the world that, and it's going
to
give you.
What if I was to say though that, and I'm not disputing that you can change things on a local level, but for example, in New Zealand, and I'm sure that they're everywhere, and where each person who's currently talking, we have, what do they call them? National Heritage Parks, or I can't remember the
name for them. What's interesting about New Zealand that I've heard from some of my friends that lived there for a few years, they said that you guys have a class system, which I didn't realize that you guys did.
I don't know that I'd agree with that. I'm not saying that the...
And they told me, too, that not only is there a class system, but the upper echelon purposely tries to keep everyone down. They like to keep it just...
I don't doubt that. But that's elitism. Isn't that everywhere?
I don't think that there's much... I mean... I don't know. My observation, I mean, there's a class system in sense, but like not like I've heard it, not like it was explained to me about New Zealand, which I was shocked because I didn't think that existed.
It could be that I've never got close enough to it to find out. that's quite likely. But what I was about to say though was we had these national heritage parks, right? Which or international heritage parks, I can't remember what the correct term is. They have special brown signs on the road, you know, like Fiordland, and so what that means is that those parks have been handed over to the UN, to international ownership effectively, and New Zealand is a steward of it, but we are not allowed to do with it what we want to. It's no longer ours. It's part of like the locking up of the wild areas throughout the world. And so, you know, you can say you can make changes on a local level, and I'm not disputing that. But if you try to change something that conflicts with a piece of legislation that's already in place that prevents you from doing whatever you want to do, then you're not going to get anywhere with that. And when you find that the decisions for your local area are being made by people who perhaps live in a completely different part of the world, i.e., you know, Agenda 21 or 2030 or whatever you want to call it, I don't think that document is necessarily all that relevant, because I don't doubt that they'll go to a new version anyway. But the point is, you end up bound by legislation written by people who don't live in the area where it's affected. They were never voted into office at all, and you're under technocratic rule.
I don't know. I you're talking about a national park. I don't know how to.
That was only an example. So,
firstly, I do think we should preserve some of our nature. So, I mean, in the sense of things are being preserved, I guess who would object to that, you know?
Yeah, no, that was merely an example, but you'll find that Christchurch is under a rebuild at the moment, which is still ongoing, probably will be for about another 50 years. Due to the earthquakes, and the street designs have been turned into a nightmare where all the local people are objecting because they're totally dysfunctional, and of course they've all been redesigned.
This is very insightful, just speaking about, so you said
Christchurch.
That's Christchurch, and they had a big earthquake there in New Zealand, right? So did it displace a lot of people? So those people were forced to move to other parts of New Zealand? Is that like what occurred?
Certainly a lot of people did move to other parts of New Zealand. Perhaps forced, that was choice as much as anything. I mean, in the short term, were they forced out of their homes? Absolutely. But The people who left because they wanted to leave. But yeah, it's been a massive upheaval on the population, but then it also resulted in a big influx of people from all over New Zealand and all over the world for the work and the fraud and the massive influx of billions and billions and billions of dollars. Yeah. But, you know, I guess what I was saying about that was that you'll find that there's designs coming into our street plan, which comes straight out of the Agenda 21 design for the interiors of cities now to be not user-friendly to vehicles and user-friendly to push bikes and all that kind of thing. And you may agree with that policy. You may go, hey, that's great, let's get rid of the cars. And that's fine if that's where you are, but what the point is that then you find that your life's being ruled by someone who doesn't live where you are, who was never elected into office. So it's legislation without representation. It's technocratic rule.
Well, isn't driving a privilege?
Well, isn't eating a privilege?
I know. Well, that's why I say driving's a privilege. I guess that people don't.
Isn't not getting shot a privilege?
Well, I think there's definitely a focus to move the populations into cities, but I think in a short period of time, I think people are going to start moving away from cities.
Yeah, stack 'em and pack 'em.
Well, that's what happened.
But,
it's cyclical. Everything's cyclical. Everything moves in. You know, there was a time where no one wanted to live in the cities, and then everyone wanted to live in the cities. I mean, ancient Rome went from 1 million people down to like 10,000 people, supposedly. You know, because they taxed.
Yeah, but see, I'm not a person who. I'm not good at citing a lot of historical examples, but, you know, if John Adams was here, he could rattle off case after case after.
I'm just saying, like, I mean, if you look at it from that perspective, I mean, whether it's true or not true in the sense of that, I think we can obviously say that, hey, there. I don't know what it's like in New Zealand because I haven't been there, but in the United States, there's been a lot of like, for example, the city of Boston or even the city of New York and stuff like that. I mean, you know, New York City used to be called the Rotten Apple. It was, like, just awful, like, how dirty it was and everywhere. Like, even in, like, the nice parts of Manhattan, and now it's, like, all money. So there's, like, this real concentration of wealth that was brought back into the cities, right?
Yeah.
And so all that money's moving in the cities because for a while there it was all moved to the suburbs outside the cities, right? I mean, this isn't even that long here in the United States that there's been a shift from people being in the rural areas to people moving to cities, you know? At least that's...
Yeah, I don't doubt that these things are cyclical in nature in that sense, but the real question is, are these things organic in nature? Are they occurring because the citizenry of their own free will, without influence from outside whatsoever, just happen to be making those decisions, or is it a product of social engineering on a grand scale?
Well, I have a question. Do you guys have unleaded gas in New Zealand?
Yeah, only unleaded gas.
Okay, so because there was a time when they had lead in the gasoline, correct? Which probably
that's
is
the reason
you're going to die of cancer because of that lead.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. And we banned it all and got rid of it, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay. Interesting. But that's, I'm just saying, you know, another... I don't know. I don't know if they would get rid. I mean, I can see what you're saying about trying to get rid of cars. I mean, even where I live. I mean, I don't know. They didn't design it for public transportation where I live. But
well,
I mean,
well, I'm not even saying. I don't mean to imply that these things are always necessarily bad. I mean, let's face it. If there is a better method of transport, that's great. But you know, I actually think. Personally, that we're moving towards heavily controlled transit in the future. And that may be a fair way away, but I actually think that's where they're going to go. But it's not really the question about whether or not the new system's better. It's whether the new system arose because the citizenry of their own free will brought it into place or whether or not it was foisted upon them.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to have to let you guys go. It's really a pleasure speaking with you guys, and
honestly, I just loved it. Thank you guys so much, and I'm fortunately I have to go. So.
Yeah, no worries. You too.
All right, you guys have a good night or day or whatever it is where you guys are at.
Yeah, middle of the day. See you later. Everybody gone? Nobody there? Right, well, I've got a terrible singing voice. I'm not going to do a solo, and I have to do some work, so I'm just going to mute out.
Buonanotte for me.
Hey, folks, Alex Jones here. You're listening to Fakeologist Radio at fakeologist.com.